Welcome to Art Bell Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from September 22nd, 1997.
From the high desert in the great American Southwest, I bid you all good evening or good morning as the case may be across all these many time zones. From the Tahitian and Hawaiian Islands in the west, all the way eastward over flyover country, us, to the Caribbean and the U.S. Virgin Islands, south into South America, north to Santa Country at the pole. And even beyond all that, worldwide on the internet, this is Coast to Coast AM. I'm Art Bell. Good morning. Boy, is there a lot going on. Whew. Let me give you a brief sketch of what's coming up this week on Coast. Tonight, we'll learn what's really been going on in Egypt, because Boris Said is here, and he's finally ready to speak. And he'll tell you why it has taken him this long to go public. Boris Said tonight will be talking about the pyramids, a subject very, very close to my heart, since in about a week I'm going to be there. Tomorrow night, it'll be David John Oates, who, as a matter of fact, is up in Alaska right now, and more reverse speech. As a matter of fact, you can look forward to reverses on Mark Furman, Brother Iran Mohammed. Remember Brother Mohammed? The Queen on Princess Di. Area 51 calls, including that wild call that may have knocked us off the air. And the President himself, President Clinton. That'll be tomorrow night with David John Oates. Wednesday, it'll be Professor of Theoretical Physics at New York University, Michio Kaku. Professor Kaku back once again. And then Thursday, it'll be Guy Finley, who will be here talking about, in some ways, the quickening, the intimate enemy. And that would be us. Friday night, Saturday, it'll be Bob Lazar. Bob Lazar is a physicist who says he worked at Area 51, back engineering certain portions of, you know what, circular craft that we would know as UFOs, along with Gene Huff. So it's going to be quite a week this week. That is what lies directly ahead. Well, actually, directly ahead lies Boris Said. He'll be here in a moment. I've got to update a number of things. Danyon Brinkley continues to be better by the second. He's up eating solids and feeling great. So it looks like the prayers out there worked. Thank you all. Danyon Brinkley, much better. As a matter of fact, somebody's got to hold the guy down, because the minute he starts feeling better, he gets ready to go. Now, let me give you a sense of what is on the website tonight. We rushed by overnight mail photographs from Boris Said down to me, and I scanned them, of some of the things he's going to be talking about in Egypt. Those photographs are on the website right now, and we will be describing those photographs for you and what it's all about. Now, I rarely post ghost photographs, because there are not a lot of good ones. I've only had now, I think, two or maybe three good ghost photographs over all the years, what I consider to be superior. And Carol Gardner, I think that's correct, I hope that's correct, Carolyn Gardner of El Cajon, California, sent me a photograph taken 11/26/95 at the Mount Palomar Observatory in Southern California. They actually belong to a neighbor of hers, and they were taken, she and her family were visiting there. She's a little girl in the red plaid poncho. You'll see two little girls there, and they're, of course, up at an observatory, and it's a typical picture you might expect somebody would take, a memento. But I'll tell you what. You look above the girl's head on the right, and you tell me what you see. If this isn't a ghost photograph, I don't know what it is. Sure looks like a ghost to me. An awfully good photograph. So we've got a new ghost photograph on the website. The website is about to get intensely busy, so If I were you, I would get up there as quickly as possible. And there are a couple of award pictures up there. One is my wife with her picture and her awards. That incredible lightning picture that she took through a double rainbow. And you can actually see we brought the photo home and we've got all the awards and we took a photograph and I'm very proud of her. And you'll see that. And then there is somebody named Clem Jellin in St. Paul, Minnesota, who sent me her award photograph, and she has constructed the funniest thing you've ever seen in your whole life, entirely made out of garden tools. Garden tools! She has constructed a chupacabra, which won an award at a fair, and I laughed so hard when I saw this that I could not resist, so I scanned it and put it up there. It is it looks like a chupacabra. Looks like a purple people eater or something. Anyway, you decide for yourself. It is one of the most ingenious things I've ever seen anybody do. That photograph is up there for you to see right now. Then there were a couple of, and I want to thank the gentleman, I don't think I have his name, I'm going to have to punch this up myself, who sent these photographs in from Florida, which I scanned, of a couple of funnel clouds, and absolutely, actually this is David Gardner from Cape Coral, Florida, who sent a couple of incredible, incredible photographs of funnel clouds in Florida. So there you have it. Now, let's see, what else? Oh yes, this is going to be a very, very big week on the Rogue Market. My stock is now going through the roof, so I am prepared to make you rich. Rich, rich, rich in Rogue dollars. You will have more fun on the Rogue Market. Now, as you log on to my website, on the left-hand side, under Daily Stops at the bottom, you will see the Rogue Market. All you've got to do is click on that, go over there, fill out a form. You'll get 10,000 Rogue dollars. Fill out yet another form, and you get 5,000 more. Then go to the listings area. You know, click on market and then listings and go to talk radio and you will see all the major talk hosts across the U.S. And I would urge you to buy Art Bell stock. Now, the trick is buy it early because the price is going to go through the roof. We're going to go over 10,000 this week. I guarantee you by the end of the week it'll be over 10,000. As a matter of fact, over the next couple of days, I'll bet you it goes over 10,000. So if you buy early, that's how the market works with a rising stock. You buy early, and then as everybody else buys, yours becomes worth more. Now, you're not risking any real money. Stop sending letters to me asking me where I'm listed on the NASDAQ or the Dow Jones. This is the Rogue Market, not the real market, but it operates just like a real market. As a matter of fact, if you make enough money, they will give you a prize. And this is your opportunity to, you know, make some real money. So buy Art Bell stock on the Rogue Market. There are about 8 or 10 different reasons to go zooming up to the website. A brand new and really spiffy ghost photograph. I want your feedback on that. The Rogue Market, of course. The pictures of the twisters, which are outstanding. The award photograph of my wife. And, well, let me see. What have we got? Boris Said directly ahead. So let me just sort of update you on a couple of things going on in the world. We will get Boris on here in a moment. Headlines, Clinton denies wrongdoing. What would one expect? President admits wrongdoing. President Clinton says neither he nor the vice president engaged in any illegal activity in their fundraising during the 1996 campaign. Maybe someday we'll do a show about headlines the way they really ought to read. What would it read instead of Clinton denies wrongdoing? Clinton urges test ban ratified, a worldwide test ban treaty. Nice if you can do it. Try and get China to agree. NASA begins a shuttle countdown. They're going back to Mir. Despite, again, very severe troubles on Mir. We're going to put an American on board. It is an experiment in mortal terror. There's no question about it. An experiment in mortal terror, and I really don't think that we should be putting another American on there, but ho-hum. Troubles arrived in threes Monday at the Mir space station just days before the U.S. space shuttle Atlantis is to be launched to visit the ailing station. First, Mir's main computer failed for the third time in 3 weeks. That problem followed by two brand new ones, failure of a carbon dioxide removal system, and the appearance of a mysterious leak of brown fluid. Those on the Mir, two Russians and American astronaut Michael Foll, were not in danger, space officials insisted, and as planned, NASA's countdown for Thursday's Atlantis launch proceeded. So there you have it. There, we're going to send another American up to this experiment in mortal terror. One other very sad note, the passing of Kathy Keaton Guccione. Bob Guccione's wife has died. One of America's most innovative publishing executives has died at 58 years of age. She died, I understand, in surgery. And I am so sorry. I am so sorry, Bob. She died Friday, September 19th, at Mount Sinai Medical Center in New York City, where she recently underwent a surgical procedure to bypass an obstruction in her upper digestive tract. She, of course, spent the last 2.5 years of her life fighting to get a fair trial for the inexpensive cancer treatment drug, hydrazine sulfate. So, not a direct, I guess, a connection with her cancer, or perhaps an indirect connection, but we interviewed her, Kathy Keaton Guccione. Rest in peace. Rest in peace. And I was so, so sorry to hear that today. And to Bob, my condolences, Bob. And I'm sure many in the audience as well. Now, Bora Said. Born in Greenwich, Connecticut in 1932, educated at Deerfield Academy and Princeton University, he speaks Russian, French, Italian, Spanish, and English, and is presently learning Japanese. Woo! He is the writer-producer of Secret Chamber, a one-hour television documentary special which covered the opening of the rooms, or room, rather, under the Sphinx, which was located during the Mystery of the Sphinx research in 1992 and 3. From 1992 to 3, executive producer and writer of the 1994 Emmy Award-winning NBC TV feature documentary, The Mystery of the Sphinx, hosted by Charlton Heston. Remember that? In 1988, the director-producer of a TV documentary, The Voice of Africa, Conversations with a Zulu Witch Doctor. In 1987, executive producer, director of TV U.S. Home Video, Dolphins. In 1983, producer and co-writer of a TV industrial film entitled America First. And he has a very rich history indeed. He dislikes the use of the word metaphysics. Says, neither do I think this vast area of interest is in any way, in quotes, supernatural. I believe we humans are gradually evolving into a greater awareness of the world in which we live. And I'm not going to read all the rest of this, but he has a very rich history, has spent much time in Egypt, Nepal, South Africa, Russia, Central and South America, and the Philippines. So, widely traveled. And most recently, a member of the Shore Expedition. And as I said at the beginning of all this, if you will now go to the website, my website, for any of the many reasons I gave you a little while ago, you will see the photographs that we are about to discuss. So coming up in a moment, Bora Said. now comes Boris Saeed. Boris?
I'm here.
Welcome to the program. Am I getting your last name correct?
Saeed is fine. Yes, Art. Thanks.
Okay. Boris, I am sitting here looking at a picture and an announcement of Zahi Hawass, who, of course, is Director of Antiquities. And this regards a 1998 conference coming up on the Great Pyramids at Giza. It says here, I'm going to read it to you, Ancient Secrets Revealed, the question of who built the pyramids and how such enormous monuments were constructed have long been a source of fascination and everything from X-ray bombardment on the structures to experiments in hoisting 2-ton limestone blocks have been tried to find explanations. Through his discoveries of a tunnel under the Sphinx, air shafts in the Cheops pyramid, and of the tombs of the pyramid builders, material still largely unpublished, Dr. Zahi Hawass is now in a position to unravel many of the mysteries surrounding these edifices. So in other words, Zahi is suggesting that he is ready to tell all, particularly with regard to X-ray bombardment discoveries. And I just thought I would read that to you as sort of a setup to what you are going to tell us.
Well, if he tells us all of that, there's nothing much for anybody to say. Right?
Or maybe to taunt you a little. I don't know.
Well, my relationship with Dr. Hawass has been very smooth of late, so I don't think, certainly he's not taunting me. He's maybe taunting some of the other investigators.
Perhaps so. I, too, have been talking with Zahi. He is going to be giving me a personal tour when I get over to, when I get over there, and I'm going over in about a week. Now, anyway, what I want to do is find out. I got kind of a sketch of you. I read a little stuff here. Tell me about yourself.
Well, I don't know how much there is to tell. I sort of backed into this whole area. I used to be pretty much involved in sports. I did a lot of automobile racing, and I was on a couple of American Olympic bobsled teams, and was in the real estate business. And then through a chance meeting, really, with Dr. Jim Hertog, 12 or 13 years ago, I wound up in South Africa running a film project to interview a Zulu high priest, a high sanusi, or witch doctor, if you like. And that's what got me into this business. I got from that, I guess I went to filming some dolphins in Florida with some sports photographers. And
right.
Was involved there with some studies of autistic children, and we wound up slowing the dolphins down with super slow motion so the kids could see them better and that sort of thing. And then I ran into John Anthony West, who, quite by accident, who I hadn't seen for 40 years. We'd sort of been friends when we were teenagers. And I wound up with him in the original Sphinx Project, The Mystery of the Sphinx, which was in Egypt in 1990 through 1993.
I would think a lot of the audience got an opportunity to see that. I did. I remember that. The Mystery of the Sphinx, what an incredible program. All right, see, I chewed up the first half hour, so
okay.
We'll be clear next half hour. Take a rest,
right.
And we'll come back and really bite into all of this. Boris Saeed is my guest. We're going to be talking specifically about the pyramids, what he thinks is inside, what part he played in the Shore expedition, and why he is now no longer a part of the Shore expedition. Believe me when I tell you, this will be an interesting evening. Egypt. I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from September 22nd, 1997.
We'll be right back.
Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from September 22nd, 1997.
Once again, you've got to get to my website right away. Now, it's beginning to choke a little bit on the traffic, even as much bandwidth as we have. Just be patient. If you get a server not responding message, it will eventually respond. You know what you're hearing right now, don't you? You're hearing Cusco. By the way, I'm going to be interviewing Michael Holm when I get back from Egypt. Now, back to Boris Said. Boris, welcome back.
Thank you. I'm here.
All right. Boris, first of all, you know what I would like you to do, if you can? Tell the American people why they should even be interested in the pyramids. In other words, what's the big deal?
Wow. Well, that's a tall order in itself. It's on our dollar bill. It was a Masonic symbol. Certainly it had great significance to our founding fathers. There's all that stuff about the pyramids. I have my own theory, and which I'd really like to share with you, which I was hoping I'd be able to share in this shore expedition film, which now seems like it's not going to happen.
Well, we'll get to that, but the overall sort
of... My feeling, Art, is this in a large sense, that there were ancient civilizations that were as advanced or more highly advanced as our own. You can call them Atlantis, Mu, Lemuria, whatever. I believe there were ancient civilizations. And I don't believe that those people, those advanced scientists, hid their secrets from the world like a dog buries a bone. I don't think that you've got to dig in the ground for buried treasure because that's what the pirates used to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I happen to believe that the pyramid, for one, is an example, towering 450 feet above the plateau, of advanced science. There are countless mathematical formulas expressed in the pyramids. Astronomers claim, and Robert Bovall wrote a brilliant book, The Orion Mysteries, about the alignment of the air shafts or star shafts with the planets of Orion, where the pharaohs allegedly made their home in the afterlife long before, long ago. We found an even more amazing thing when we were there. We took Tom Danley, who's a sonics expert, he's a NASA consultant, to do some testing in the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid, because anybody who's been there knows there are some very strange resonances, and if you lie in what they call a sarcophagus, which I don't believe is a sarcophagus, and you hum or you chant, there are certain notes which seem to connect you with the pyramid. It's like you just get into kind of an altered state if you lie in there and chant. So Danley went in and did some measurements. And we took sensors and we placed them in the five chambers above the King's Chamber. And then we put a huge set of amplifiers and woofers in the King's Chamber and began to test resonances.
Huh.
Now, Danley found that, and I think he's been on your program, Danley found that there were certain resonances or vibrations or musical tones, it all means the same thing, which were resonant in the King's Chamber and which were reinforced by the structure of the chamber. And these five notes, according to Danley, formed a chord, and musicologists like Jim Hertog and our composer Fritz Heed worked with these notes, and they found them to produce an F-sharp chord. Now, I'm not a musicologist. I'm a filmmaker. I'm a documentarian. But ancient text, according to Jim Hertog, the Egyptian ancient text relate that F-sharp was a harmonic of the earth. In other words, it was a vibration in harmony with the earth. And other teachers and spiritualists have suggested that F-sharp is a harmonic of the human being, of the body. All that is fine, and I felt was quite abstract.
It is. Boris, do you know the frequency, produce the actual frequency?
I have a set of those frequencies, and I could get. I don't have them at my fingertips. No.
I think it's very low, down around 7 or 8 hertz, something like that.
Well, I was getting to that. What happened was, when Danley got back to his studio in Chicago and examined his recordings, he found that there were some vibrations resonant in the chamber which were below the range of human hearing.
Right.
And they occurred even when he wasn't making any sound.
To give the audience an idea, when we come and go from commercial breaks, we play a 25 hertz, what's called subaudible tone, which causes the radio station's equipment to run the commercials and so forth and so on. And then we play another one when we come back. These are subaudible tones at about 25 hertz. What we're talking here about, which the human ear really can't hear unless you amplify it greatly, we're talking about even much lower frequencies. The frequency thought to be the frequency of the very Earth itself, which was around 8 hertz. I don't know whether it still is or not.
Danley's notes were below 9 hertz. The lowest five notes he picked up were from half a hertz to 9 hertz.
Wow.
Now, the interesting thing about it is that when we raised those notes 3 or 4 octaves so that you could hear them, lo and behold, they produced the same F-sharp chord. Now, where did the sound come from? What Danley believes, and you've got to remember that the pyramids used to have smooth sides, Danley believes that the ambient wind coming off the Sahara Desert, blowing across the ends of the air shafts, created a flute-like effect and created these vibrations. That little bit of air through those tiny 8-inch shafts, exciting 2.5 million blocks of granite. It seems absurd, but in Danley's own words, he says, it may seem unlikely, but the sounds are there. Here they are on the graph. Here they are on the computer.
All right, that's a monstrous version, Boris, isn't it, of kind of like taking a Coke bottle and going,
exactly.
And getting the resonance?
Exactly. And that was the example, precise example that I planned to use in my film, was we've got a guide with an Egyptian Coca-Cola bottle blowing across the end of it.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, that's it. The great thing about it, Art, is this. 4 months later, I was in Oregon in the Columbia River Valley with my friend Ward Stroud, who is a Yaqui Indian. He's a maker of ceremonial flutes. And lo and behold, his flutes are sacred to Mother Earth, and they're sacred instruments, and they're tuned to, you guessed it, F-sharp, as are many of the American sacred flutes. They're tuned to F-sharp because the shamans felt that this was a harmonic of Mother Earth, a sound sacred to Mother Earth.
So in other words, the Great Pyramid itself could be something, Boris, connected to Earth itself for some reason.
Yes, exactly. And
wow.
It's connected, Art. It's connected with mathematics. Karl Monk has done some amazing theories, and there are formulas that describe the circumference of the Earth and the location of the pyramids of Teotihuacan and all sorts of wonderful things. So there are all of these sciences expressed in this structure, which we persist in calling a tomb.
You don't think it's a tomb?
No, I don't think it's a tomb for a very simple reason. They've never found a body there. There are no decorations. It is unlike any other tomb in Egypt if it's a tomb.
Therefore, if it is not a tomb, what do you believe it to be?
I believe that it was a scientific instrument. I believe that its sonic significance was that it would produce an altered state. I think they're doing some work at Harvard and also at Stanford, which we're trying to get our hands on at the moment. But if you subject the human body to a bombardment of certain key low vibrations or low frequencies for a week or two, it may tend to produce an altered state, make the body more accessible to healing, may even create out-of-body states.
Do you want to really go out on a limb and perhaps speculate about ultimately what you think this altered state might be? And I guess I'll just tell you where I'm driving. In other words, could the pyramids possibly, Boris, be some sort of stargate?
Well, that's what I think they are. I mean, you said it, and so you said it first. I think it's very strange if you stop to think that if the pyramids were in fact built in 3500 BC, for the first 1,000 years of their existence, not a single mummy of a pharaoh was ever found in Egypt.
By the way, do you believe they were built then?
I have nothing to base it on, Art. I believe the Sphinx is older, only because of the brilliant work that I think Robert Schott from Boston University did in identifying the marks on the outside. But the problem with the pyramids is you don't have an outside. It's been stripped away.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know when they were built, but I tend to think they're older. I mean, if you ask me for an opinion, I'd think they were older.
All right.
But assuming they were built in 3500 B.C., there was the first pharaonic, the first pharaoh's body that was ever found, I believe, was in 2550 B.C. So where were they all before that? What happened to them? And why did they have mummies in the first place? I mean, what was the purpose of preserving the body? And what was the purpose of creating this solar boat for the pharaoh's trip to the afterlife? Unless the Egyptians believed that somehow the pharaoh would go into that structure, and the priests would somehow send him into another state. That's what I believe it is.
Well, they were put in there after death, not just prior to, weren't they?
Well, it all depends on who you believe. I mean, yeah, that's what history tells us. But were they?
Boy, that's a very good question. One might imagine that that trip would be made while what we know as the soul would still be within the body, which might suggest they might try to get them in there just prior to death.
Yes, or possibly they might just put them in there when they were ready to go and create an out-of-body trance and send them on their way. There have been suggestions, according to Jim Hertzog, there's some suggestions that the pharaohs were tested on their knowledge of the universe before they were allowed access into the afterlife. And so perhaps when the pharaoh thought he was ready, he just went and got in the box and the priests made their sounds and away he went.
Let me ask you a little bit about the, you said in the beginning, if you go into the Great Pyramid and you lie in the sarcophagus and you spend time, that you will begin to enter in some sort of altered state. Have you tried this yourself?
Yes, I have.
And?
Well, I've had a lot of very strange experiences there. I had one which was witnessed, which was documented, and that was that we were in there for the night, and I was there with another person, and I had some Tibetan chants that Dr. Hertzog had given me, and I was playing them on quadraphonic speakers in the room.
Yes.
And I had a sensation that I was going out through the top of the pyramid, and I can remember, and this was 1992, and we were in the middle of our Mystery of the Sphinx show, and I had the distinct impression that I was walking in the rain, and I thought, well, now this is strange, you know, that I must be dreaming about my own show, because, of course, we'd stated that rain had damaged the pyramid and the Sphinx. And I wound up, of all things, playing backgammon in a cafe at the foot of the Sphinx. There's a cafe where a lot of friends of mine play backgammon late at night.
Uh-huh.
And I wound up playing backgammon with them. Now, you know, as some people go back and become Tutankhamun and other people go get the dance with Nefertiti, right? I went and played a little backgammon with my buddies. And when they woke me up, I was very disappointed to come to in the pyramid. I thought to myself, well, I slept through my first night in the pyramid. You know, what a bore. And as we were walking down the stairs, my companion said, you know, what did you experience? And I said, well, I went for a walk in the rain. And she said, that's ridiculous. It's July. Mm-hmm. Well, when we got outside the pyramid, that was the first shocker, because it had rained all morning, all night. And on into the morning, there were puddles everywhere.
Really?
Absolutely. And you can believe this or not, and I'm not sure that I believe it or not, but when I went down to the backgammon game that night,
mm-hmm,
I remembered something about having an incredible run of doubles from my dream. And I thought it was a dream. When I got down there, there was a wooden table, which is still there today. You can see it next week when you go, in which my friends had carved the run of doubles, two double sixes, a double four, and two double ones. And they had carved it into the table and said they'd never play the game with me again. Now,
boy, oh boy.
That's a pretty wild story.
Yes, it is.
I've probably discredited myself now for the rest of the year.
No, not at all, because I think everybody believes there is something to this. And I think that there is some sort of key with low frequencies, and it would make sense to me that if that is not some simple burial place for people, that it is indeed attached to the earth for a very specific, as you said, scientific purpose. And we need to discover that.
That's
and
right.
That would suggest that in some ways there was a civilization in some way far advanced from where we are right now in a different sort of way. Would that be fair?
I absolutely believe it. I can't imagine that not being the case.
If there was this great civilization prior to ours, something the Christians will get very angry if we consider seriously here, and they built this instrument, this scientific instrument, literally into, in combination with the Earth, then what may lie ahead? In other words, what may we yet discover? What secrets do you think the pyramid may yet hold, and the Sphinx?
Well, certainly they must have a lot to do with energy. Because if you look at the size of those stones, we, in the Mystery of the Sphinx, interviewed a crane operator
yes.
who couldn't imagine how, even with modern cranes, you could place 200-ton stones from a sand base. They must have had something to do with energy. If you go to Baalbek in Lebanon, the stones weigh 1,500 tons, and they're piled 3 and 4 courses high. So obviously they must have known something about, it must have been easier for them to lift stones than cut them. Otherwise, why would the stones be so big?
Well, that is another topic by itself. In fact, the Japanese, I believe, tried to duplicate, didn't they, Boris?
Yes, and failed.
And failed.
Absolutely. There must be a knowledge there having to do with energy, having to do with an awareness of where we are. Somebody told me an amazing thing today. I mean, we're one day after the autumnal equinox, if I've said that correctly.
Mm-hmm.
It was yesterday. It is apparently a fact, though I don't know it, that from outer space, if you look down at the Earth, on the day of the spring and the autumn equinoxes, on those 2 days,
yes.
as the sun is leaving the pyramid of the sun at Teotihuacan, it is beginning to shine on the pyramid of Giza, and only on that one day. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but it's been confirmed to me by a couple of people. It seems sort of unlikely, but why not?
All right, there is some thought that within or beneath the Sphinx, the paw of the Sphinx, may lie chambers in which something called the Hall of Records may reside. Now, that would be, or I guess is said to be, a sort of library documenting all the technology of this previous civilization. Is that correct?
That's the story, yes.
You believe that?
Let's put it this way. I know there's a chamber there because I've seen it on 2 different scientific instruments. In 1991, Dr. DeBecky documented a 30 by 40 foot rectangular anomaly about 35 feet below the surface under the paws of the Sphinx, and he did that with seismic technology. We went back there in the spring of 1996, and Dr. DeBecky, with ground-penetrating radar, confirmed that there was, in fact, a rectangular anomaly under the paws.
This was part of the Shore Expedition or
this
not?
This was the first time was the West, the John West Expedition.
John Anthony West.
Yes, and the second time was with part of the Shore Expedition.
So, in other words, through ultrasound, and then now through X-ray as well, there's confirmation in both technologies that there is a chamber indeed under the Sphinx.
Right. Now, what's in it? That's another story. I'm perfectly willing to accept that there's a library down there, but I think that I still believe that the obvious clue to the existence of an advanced technology is 500 feet above the Earth in plain sight. I mean, you can walk in there for $6 and have a look at it and measure and test and to your heart's content. There's nothing secret about it. We just don't understand how to figure it out yet. Like Rubik's Cube or something, you know. If you don't know how to do it, you can't do it.
All right, Boris, that's a good place to hold it. We'll be back after the top of the hour. Take a rest. It's going to be a very interesting night. There's no question about it. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from September 22nd, 1997.
I see them blue for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. Skies of blue and clouds of white.
Networks presents Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight's program originally aired September 22nd, 1997.
Ora Said is my guest, and we're talking about the Great Pyramid, the Sphinx, Egypt, the Shore Expedition, Zahi Hawass, and what the pyramids really are. What do you think they are? Something that operates at the Earth's frequency, literally at the Earth's frequency, down around 8, or now perhaps as high as 9 Hertz. What could it be? Who put it there? How did it get there? What's it for? Altered states, lying in the sarcophagus? I went out during the break and asked my wife if next week, when we're in Egypt, she would like to lie in the sarcophagus. She said, no, not me. There was somebody there before me, and I've got my own plans. So she wouldn't do it, but I think I would. I think I might. Anyway, back to Bora Said in a moment. All right, well, an expert on the pyramids. Once again, here is Bora Said. Boris, welcome back.
I don't know if I'm an expert on the pyramids, Art. I'm a documentarian who's had some extraordinary experiences there. I don't think anybody's an expert on the pyramids.
Well, that's a good point. And I guess we are just, you know, a lot of what we're talking about is conjecture regarding why they're there, how they got there, and what they're for.
Exactly. I think the one thing that's at the bottom of all of this is that we've got to look at it. I think that to simply dismiss something that awesome as a tomb and ignore the fact that there are pyramids in England and Japan and China and Tibet and
Mexico,
all through Central and South America, is doing somebody a disservice, doing us ourselves a disservice by not investigating these things.
How can you imagine, since you mentioned that, Boris, that I can certainly imagine in Egypt, for some reason that we might not imagine, they came up with the concept of the pyramids and built them somehow. All right, but the rest of the world, I mean, the rest of the world then was not even connected. So how could pyramids appear across the rest of the face of the globe?
Well, it's a great question. If we're going to view the thing three-dimensionally, I mean, I heard you say that my good friend Michio Kaku is going to be on Wednesday night.
He's yes, he is.
A great believer in the fact that you cannot understand the universe if you look at it as three dimensions. If you look at the drawings on the plains of Nazca, and try and imagine how they could have been done by somebody on the ground, so many of the monuments all over our world had to have been conceived from a height. Otherwise, how do they manage to make them? How do they manage to do these huge drawings that span miles, acres?
I don't have a clue.
That's right. So to assume, first of all, I think it's wrong to assume that the first pyramids were in Egypt, because we don't know where the first pyramids were. I mean, there's one in China that's now destroyed down to, I guess, to within 10 feet of the ground. It's supposed to be a mile on a side.
Whew. Which they date to when?
I don't know. I don't think they do. I don't think they can. I don't think there's enough of it. The problem is that you get experts in that field, and they pontificate, and they say, well, this is the date. And that's where their error is.
They're guessing.
That's right.
There really is no way, carbon dating and all the rest of that, there's no way.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know enough about it. I understand that there's a way now of establishing that there's some sort of cosmic radiation, and you can measure that if you get the right kind of samples. But again, that's over my head. What I'm advocating is that we look at these things, and we look at them and not hide them, and not pretend that they're not there, and above all, not keep this knowledge from people who are curious, who are interested, who would like to have opinions on it.
Well, I certainly agree with you regarding Professor Kaku, who will be here Wednesday, that it is arrogant for us to believe that we can understand all looking at things in simply three dimensions, when there may be many, many more, which will bring insights and instant understanding when we can get to those dimensions. And one has to wonder if what we've been discussing about the frequency and the altered states produced inside the Great Pyramid might not be the gate to get one to that understanding.
Well, every civilization before ours has believed in something of that sort. The Zulus and the Aborigines and the Maoris and the Native Americans, the Hopis, all believed that there was a way of getting to the center of the earth, or in any event, to get out of here, to get into another dimension.
Mm-hmm.
So why suddenly are we not believing this?
All right. I've got a couple of tough questions for you. I guess we better start with, you became involved with the Shore Expedition how long ago?
Okay, and I became involved with the Shore Expedition in 1995.
95.
In the summer, in the fall of 1995.
And what was the idea? What was the expedition going to do?
Well, let me start one step back, Mark. I had gone to Egypt in August, basically on a free ticket from TWA on some air miles, because nothing was happening. I was trying to market a program, oddly enough, about Michio Kaku's work. And I went to call on Dr. Hawaz because I thought that we had used him rather badly in Mystery of the Sphinx. He had opposed everything John West wanted to do, and I thought he sort of came off as the bad guy in the film.
John West, actually, Anthony, is not allowed at Giza now, is he, or is he now allowed back?
Well, I don't know, and Art, I got to tell you that there is so much hurling of rocks and epithets and what one guy said and somebody else said. I don't know. John seems to have a knack for making people angry. I don't want any part of it. I had an expedition with John. It was, I thought, quite successful. It didn't end so well, but we certainly approved a point in spite of all the acrimony that there was between the Egyptian officials and John West. And I think that we established that there was probably a chamber under the Sphinx. I think Dr. DeBecky would rather use the word possibly, but in any event, certainly there was something worth investigating there, and I think that we established pretty clearly that a case for an older Sphinx, which is what we set out to do, and it entertained a lot of people, and John won an Emmy and so forth. To make a long story short, I walked into Zahi's office in August, and I said, look, you know, I have an apartment here in Egypt and a horse, and I'd like to know whether there's something I can do to make this up to you. And he said, let's do another film. And I will be your Egyptian host and whatever, what would we do a film about? And we had a very affable lunch. And I suggested to him something I'd always wanted to do, which was a documentary about legends surrounding the Great Sphinx. I mean, there are legends of King Solomon. There are all kinds of wonderful legends. And Zahi said, yeah, fine, let's do that. And how can I help you? And I said, well, I'd like to bring a crew over, and we'll film you talking about Legends of the Sphinx. So he said, yes, I'll do that. And I went back to New York, and I raised $50,000 from two investors and went back to Egypt with a crew, and we filmed Dr. Hawaz in talking about pyramids and tunnels and all sorts of wonderful things.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point, he said, well, where, Boris, do you think this thing will be shown? And I said, I think it'll be a cable show. And he said, well, why not a network? And I said, because I think if you want to have a network show, you've got to have some extraordinary piece of news, something that will get their attention.
Sure.
And he said, what about if we open a tunnel that's never been opened before? And I said, where? And he said, under the Sphinx. And I said, that would do it.
That would do it.
Right. So Dr. Hawaz took us out to the rear of the Sphinx one day with our crew following along obediently. And he crawled down into a hole under the tail of the Sphinx, which we've since been in and done radar studies and found nothing, I might tell you. But there's a huge sort of an excavation inside the rump of the Sphinx, which has been all shored up like a mine shaft. And they've been prowling around in there. And Dr. Hawaz allowed himself to be filmed standing in the bottom of that hole.
Uh-huh.
And he said, it's a great quote. He wrote it. I wish I'd written it. He said, even Indiana Jones wouldn't dream to be here now. We're now inside the body of the Sphinx, and we don't know where this tunnel leads, but we're going to open it for the first time. So with that in hand, with that statement in hand and some lovely sort of images of the Sphinx and the pyramids, I came back to New York and set about selling a documentary.
To one of the networks. This time you're going to the network.
And I went to the network. And one of the networks did, in fact, express some interest. And they said, look, if you're really going to open this thing, sure, we're interested. So at that point, I talked to Dr. Shore, who I knew had a great interest in this and who I'd talked to before I went the first time and told them what I was going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Shore said, well, we'd like to get involved, and I think the next amount of money we needed was $100,000, and he said, well, I'll put up the $100,000, and we entered into a joint venture agreement, and the deal was that he was going to be in charge of all science, and I was going to do the filming.
And when was this agreement entered into?
In December of 1955.
December?
1995.
95,
sorry.
Okay.
So we then went back to Egypt in March with a full crew for, I think, almost 5 weeks. And we filmed some beautiful tombs on the West Bank, and we filmed in Luxor, and then we came down to the Giza Plateau, and Dr. DeBecky joined us, and there was a lot of ground-penetrating radar and sonar exploration of the plateau.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Shore had a 5-year permit from the Egyptian government, renewable each year, and that was what he was operating under, and I had a permit to film his work. And he was paying the expenses at that point. Every time we needed more money, I would say, shall I raise some money? And he would say, no, I'll put it up. And so he became de facto the financial sponsor of the project.
Mr. Shore?
Yes,
uh-huh.
Dr. Shore,
uh-huh.
And his foundation. In April and early May, Dr. DeBecky, with ground-penetrating radar, confirmed what he'd found in 1991 with his seismic work. He confirmed that there was, in fact, a chamber under the paws of the Sphinx, that it looked to be about 30 by 40 feet, and it looked to be about 35 feet below the surface. But, of course, it's we're dealing with shadows and disturbed earth. And
nevertheless, again, this is the X-ray, ground-penetrating,
yes,
X-ray that was confirming what the ultrasound had already done.
Exactly. He also, around the back of the Sphinx, discovered a tunnel about 2 meters wide that seemed to be about 15 feet below the surface, coming out of the tail of the Sphinx and heading in a westerly direction up under the causeway towards the Khafre or Chephren pyramid. Now, at that point, Dr. Shore requested permission to do some diamond drilling and drill a hole down into the under the paw, and that was refused. They said, "Oh no, you know, you can never drill under this. You might damage the Sphinx, etc., etc." And basically, they agreed to take it under advisement. But Dr. Shore was running the permit end of things. You see, so I was just told, "Well, wait, and we'll have it for the next trip."
Mm-hmm.
So we came back in November, and in November we brought Tom Danley with us, and took Tom Danley. That's when he did his resonance experiments up in the Great Pyramid, because I felt that the whole show shouldn't just hang on
whether or not you can drill underground.
That's right. If we get underground and there's a tablet that says made in Atlantis, well, eureka, nobody will believe it anyway, right? So I thought we needed some other corroboration besides just the records. And so Danley did his work, and we filmed all of that, and we got some wonderful footage. And also we found an interesting thing. I had been told, and I got to go back away, Art, here, in 1992, one of the plateau guards for a princely sum of, I don't know, $20 or something, took me late one night down a well.
I know. Now we're getting into the area of the photographs that I've got on the website, correct?
Okay. Yes.
All right. What I'm going to want to do is, again, tell everybody the photographs we're about to discuss are on my website, if you wish to go see them, at www.artbell.com. And so with that in mind, we'll take the photographs one by one. So you paid somebody $20.
Take me down an iron ladder, a rusty iron ladder.
Where was this well?
Under the causeway, leading from the Sphinx to the Chephren Pyramid.
Uh-huh.
And it was about halfway up the causeway.
Okay.
But the story that I was told by an old Nubian guide was that the well had been dug in 1946 after the war in a search for water. And that there were two little Nubian kids down in the well chipping away with hammer and chisel, which is how they dug in those days, when the bottom of the well collapsed, and they fell about 30 feet.
Uh-huh.
When the dust had settled and they lit their torches, they found that they were sitting, to their horror, on a sarcophagus.
On a sarcophagus?
Right. And there was a tunnel, they said, leading down towards the Sphinx. And that part of the story may have been exaggerated. And in that tunnel were other sarcophagi.
Uh-huh.
And they were terrified, and they ran up out of the well, and they said, we're not going back down there, and there's no water anyway, and the thing was abandoned. I have no idea if it's a true story or not.
It might have been myth.
But 20 years later, they built the Aswan Dam, and it raised the water level, the water table, on the Giza Plateau by some 25 feet.
Right.
Or maybe even 46 feet, depending on who you believe. And to make a long story short, lo and behold, there was water in the well. And the Egyptians put a motor down there and a pump and actually pumped water out of that well for 20 years.
20 years?
Well, for quite a while.
Using it as a water source?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
From 1965 or 6 on.
Not trying to pump it out, just
using it as a water source. Now, again, that's hearsay, but that's what I was told. So in 1992, when we went down that well, at the bottom of the iron steps, which were pretty rickety, let me tell you, there was this cavern, like, that was, I would say, filled to within about 6 feet of the ceiling.
All right,
with brackish water.
Now, let me back up. I've got the first photograph, which shows the pyramid in the background, at least
yes.
a portion of it,
uh-huh.
Somebody's red car, and 1, 2, 3, 4 gentlemen there.
That's our film crew.
That's your film crew.
That's right.
And it shows this immense... is that the well?
No.
I mean, it's an immense cavern.
What we did at the time, in order to basically conceal the location, because everything was all secret, you know, we were sworn to all the secrecy.
Sure.
We filmed these guys rappelling down that shaft, which actually led nowhere.
Okay.
The well is accessible by a fairly rickety and dangerous ladder. And the well is, I would say, 120 meters west and slightly south of that shaft.
All right. Hold it right there, and we'll pick up when we get back. All right. Now, the first photograph you'll see is of this home crew standing by this immense cavern, which you can readily see would be hidden by those normal tourists around the Great Pyramid. And the second picture you'll see is of somebody rappelling down the side of this immense cavern, which Boris has just told us leads absolutely nowhere. When we come back, we'll find out exactly where we're going next. This is Coast to Coast.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from September 22nd, 1997.
Got a black magic woman. Got a black magic woman. I've got a black magic woman, got me so blind I can't see. That she's a black magic woman, she kind of made a devil of me.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight's an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from September 22nd, 1997.
My guest is Boris Said, a man who has for a very, very long time not talked. he's talking tonight, finally decided to open up and speak to us. So we will be talking in more detail with Boris in just a moment. We've got a lot to accomplish tonight, and so I suppose we had better get underway. And also, I've got a bit of a surprise for Boris coming up. Boris Said, back in a moment. Now, back to Boris Said. And Boris, let's proceed with these photographs. The next shot shows this, I guess, your cameraman, rappelling down the side of this incredible cavern that goes nowhere.
Right.
And I was thinking, here I am going to Egypt next week. I'm not going to do that.
Maybe I should stop you for a minute there, Art, because those are the two pictures that we basically took and we've talked about, because we didn't want people to know where this place really was that we'd found, because we hadn't found it scientifically. It had been a legend. It had been something we sort of stumbled on.
All right.
The rest of the pictures are absolutely accurate and depict what's going on, but I thought maybe at this juncture I should tell you why I'm suddenly talking about all this after 2 years of silence and why the need for secrecy in the first place.
Well, let's proceed. We'll get to that in a minute.
Okay.
Let's proceed with your story. I mean, here you were going down this rickety metal ladder into into a well.
Yeah, and when we got to the bottom, now this is 1992, in the dark, I had brought a rubber flashlight and a mask with me, and I brushed away some of the muck and slime that was on top of the water, and lo and behold, it was as clear as Perrier under there. And much, I think, to my guide's horror, I went in the water.
You jumped in the water?
I went in very gingerly because of all of the sediment that it aroused. And I dove down, took a couple of deep breaths, and sure enough, to the right or to the east of where we were standing, I had a compass with me, was what looked to be a pile of stones. Now, you remember the legend, right? They piled some stones up over the tunnel to protect the dead and covered over the top of the sarcophagus and got out.
In other words, these two little kids scared to death they had disturbed a sacred area, piled the rocks. Okay. Yes.
There were clearly some signs of disturbed stones down there in the bottom of that well. And I just filed that knowledge away, and we went on, and we did our film, and we left, and so forth and so on. And now the scene shifts, and we're back in 1996. And I said, when it turned out that we were not going to be allowed to drill a hole down into the room.
Right.
And when it turned out we weren't going to be able to dig down into the tunnel at the back of the Sphinx, I said to Tom DeBecky, our radar guy, listen, I know, what happens if we can get this radar of yours down 100 feet below the surface?
Hmm.
Will it operate? He said, of course. And I said, well, let me go show you this well. So we went in the well, and I'm sorry, I guess DeBecky was not with us in November when I did this. What I did was I took Danley down there in November.
Okay.
And we went down into the bottom of that well, and lo and behold, the water had receded about 15 feet.
Ah.
And there were two sarcophagi in an intermediate level of the shaft. When you descend that shaft, there is a one level about 80 feet down, and then you go down another 40 or 50 feet to the bottom. And at the 80 foot level, there were two disturbed stone sarcophagi, outer casings, with the sarcophagus missing.
Huh.
And there was also an old iron pump, and there was, you know, that obviously stuff had gone on there. But I had not seen that on my first trip in 1992, so clearly, something had been taken down, a wall or something. They had done some exploration, because when I went down in 92, it was just a well shaft without this sort of second tier.
So they'd been in there since. Yes. Uh-huh.
Now, when we got to the bottom, there was quite a lot of ground. There was a lot of water left, but there was an awful lot of space that hadn't been there before. And there were a couple of bones, obviously human bones, a femur. There were some little bits of faience. There were clearly some 90-degree angles and so forth and so on. It was obviously had been a chamber of some sort.
Yes.
So when I got back, I said to Dr. Shore, look, I think we should take the radar down there and see what's down there. And this now, we're at the end of 1996, at the end of the November expedition. And this is where the whole thing started to come apart. Now, again...
All right. Well, all right, but if I might, let's finish up with the photographs. There is now a third photograph of several gentlemen, one with a laptop computer, but you're in
That's Tom DeBecky. That's our seismic expert.
All right. That's Mr. DeBecky.
We are down in the well chamber with the radar.
To me, it looks like a gigantic cavern.
Yes, except that it's got some right angles. It's got, when you're down there, there's clearly some walls. There are some steps cut out of one wall. There are some right angles and some what look to be collapsed columns.
Okay. Indeed.
It is not a natural cavern.
And then there is one final photograph, perhaps the most intriguing of all, and I can't exactly tell what I'm looking at here. It looks like some sort of sarcophagus.
Well, what happened was when we went down in November, when we went down in February, when we went back, and this is the expedition we got to talk about later, in clearing a level area to put our tripod, I mean, it's like the old story. Sounds corny when you say it, but we were setting our tripod up so that we could do a sweep of the room with the cine camera.
Right.
And the more we made an area flat, the flatter it got until we realized it was, in fact, a flat piece of stone. And when we took some of the water and washed it off, it turned out that it was polished black granite. And when we cleaned it off some more, the edges were beveled, and it was clearly the lid of a sarcophagus.
Clearly, that's what it is.
Clearly, there's no question that that's what it is.
I imagine at this point you're feeling like Indiana Jones.
Yes. I mean, we were beside ourselves, and so we immediately sort of wired Mr. DeBecky up. We had a bosun's chair to make it a little easier to get down. And we sent Mr. DeBecky and his equipment and his son down into that chamber and turned the radar on, and lo and behold, there was no sarcophagus under the lid. And the lid is almost 2.5 feet thick, according to Mr. DeBecky. It's colossally thick. We did a minimum of digging. It was illegal to dig. We didn't want to do any digging. We didn't want to upset anybody. So we had the radar, and he said the thing is more than half a meter thick.
Uh-huh.
What he did find under this sarcophagus lid was a 2.5 meter wide, quote, anomaly, unquote, with a domed ceiling.
What? So a 2.5 meter
wide, like a tunnel. He said that it was impossible for it to be a natural anomaly because it was, quote, steeply dipping, unquote. I'm quoting Tom DeBecky now, steeply dipping. It descended at an angle of about 25 degrees. It started out about 2.5 meters below the sarcophagus lid and descended directly in the direction of the Sphinx, 275 yards away.
Headed right for the Sphinx.
Yes, it is 2.5 meters wide and has a domed ceiling.
All right, so in other words, if I'm guessing, and I talked to you earlier about this, you said they frequently would use sarcophagus lids to hide things.
Well, now, this is according to our good friend and scientific consultant, Dr. Jim Hertog, who was with us from the Academy of Future Science. He said that in the ancient texts there were a lot of references to the fact that in those days, because there was no such thing as grave robbers, they would often conceal a sacred chamber or a secret tunnel or something by putting what looked to be a sarcophagus there so that nobody would think of disturbing it.
In those days, it certainly would have worked.
That's right. So certainly it fit the legend of the story. I mean, if it can be, how old, I had a line in my script, how old does the story have to be before it becomes a legend? It clearly fit the story that I'd been told 6 years before about that area.
Uh-huh.
And as far as I was concerned, that was all the proof I needed. And I went to Dr. Shore and I said, look, why don't we ask Dr. Hawaz to come down here and look at this? And perhaps we can persuade him to do a test with the radar, where we know that there's a tunnel.
Wouldn't you be worried that Dr. Hawass would come down there and look at the digging, albeit minor, that you had done and flip out?
Well, we actually sort of covered it over. I mean, the digging we did was not more than 3 or 4 inches. I mean, we really didn't do any. We just cleaned off the lid. I mean, that was covered over every night, and, you know, that was not an excavation. I mean, that was something we did with our hands and with screwdrivers, and, you know, it was not a, it wasn't an excavation. But, again, you got to understand, my relationship with Dr. Hawass has been very straightforward. He has denied me almost nothing in the past 2 years, has been very forthright with me, has allowed us to film even up above the King's Chamber, which is, of course, the subject of the Hoagland Tunnel. And so I didn't want to have a, I didn't want to get on the wrong side of the Egyptians.
Of course not.
But that's when the thing, that's when the, as they say, the it hit the fan, because that's when we found out some extraordinary stuff. At that point, when we went to the inspector and said, look, we'd like you to look at this radar test. We'd like to do a comparative test somewhere where you know there's a tunnel.
Sure.
And then compare that tunnel with the tunnel we've shown you. And then we'd like you to please dig under this lid, because the ground has already been disturbed. And it's 275 yards from the Sphinx, and we think we can do it with picks and shovels.
So at this point you were proposing, well, you proposed radar study first, followed by digging.
Yeah, I was asking Dr. Hawass to dig a hole into the tunnel.
Uh-huh.
Now, at that point, it all came apart. It turned out, to my horror, and I tell you, I never thought I was this naive, but apparently Dr. Shore's permit to explore had been revoked at the end of 1996. We are now in February of 1997.
Uh-huh. So you're operating on a revoked permit.
We are operating on my permit to film. Apparently the Egyptians had given me permission to go down and finish my film. And they had been told by the Shore Foundation that none of the equipment was going to be working, that we were just filming it.
Why had Shore's permit not been renewed or extended?
I don't know specifically, but there are two or three different stories. One is that all the permits were revoked because of all the trouble with Hancock and Bovall and West.
Yes.
I know for a fact, because I saw it, that there was a day in which Dr. Shore was engaged in doing a little illicit digging behind the stela in front of the Sphinx, and I believe that one of the inspectors saw it, put a very quick stop to it. Again, I was there and saw it, and, you know, I don't want to categorize it either way, because you can't dig 35 feet through solid rock with a chisel, but he certainly was digging, and they certainly saw it. I don't know why they revoked his permit. I don't know why he didn't tell me they revoked his permit. But I can tell you that Garrett Griffin, my director, and I were down there in that well with all our photographic equipment, and we were illegal, and we were flabbergasted.
So at this point, it might be reasonable. Mr. Shore certainly knew his permit had been revoked.
Of course.
So, or expired, not renewed, whatever
yes.
the case. And so it might be reasonable to presume that Dr. Shore, with you already there, was going to let you proceed as far as you could proceed before they stopped you.
Exactly.
Sure, okay.
Now, what I did subsequent to that, and it's a matter of record, was I delivered a letter to Dr. Hawass in which I gave him my word that I didn't know that we had no permission, and offered him that footage. I said, this footage will not be released, publicized, or made use of in any way by anyone without your specific written permission to do so.
Mm-hmm.
And I offered to give him the footage, because you know, I've been in Egypt for 10 years, and I was appalled that this had happened and we didn't know about it.
Right.
Now, at that point, you know, we're sitting in a bar that night, Garrett and I, and we're putting this whole story together. And I don't know if this is the appropriate time or not to tell you this, but I mean, this was when I began to think that we had at one point a working relationship with Graham Hancock and Robert Bovall, and we were using some of their footage in our original promo, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
And then apparently they refused to sign a secrecy pledge. And
everybody needs to know, everything at this point was extremely secret. You
yes.
weren't making any public statements at
right.
all.
Because we had agreed not to.
Refusing all interviews.
For scientific purposes, until we knew where we were. That
right.
was my pledge to Dr. Shore.
Right.
But as far as I'm concerned, all bets were off when I found out that we were operating on my permit.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I got in trouble because I, at one point, and I think it came out on your show, I asked my friend Richard Hoagland, I told him that if we did, in fact, get permission to open the tunnel, I'd invite him to be my guest there.
As a matter of fact, I, too, was tentatively, and I remember talking to you.
Yep.
And you said, oh, yes, we'd like to have you and Richard come over.
Absolutely. I didn't want any, I'm trying to sell a television show.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't see any need for secrecy. But, you know, in retrospect, it's 2020 hindsight, right? I began to realize what had happened. What you should know, Art, at this point probably, is that in February, before we ever left on this ill-fated trip, we had a meeting at Fox Network. And we had been negotiating with Fox to air the show. We'd been negotiating in good faith with them for about 3 months. And when we showed up at the final meeting, which was the week before we were to come to Egypt, in February, Fox presented us with a contract, a 54-page contract, which had half a dozen paragraphs in it that basically took total control of everything away from me. Took control of the script, of the content, of the subject matter, of everything. It basically made the film a work for hire and gave control to Fox. The payment that we were going to get was going to compensate Shore almost completely for all the money he'd put in. And my partners and I were going to wind up with one-third of half of the net profits. And as you know, in Hollywood,
sure,
there ain't no net, ever. So it could have been 150% of the net profits.
It wouldn't make any difference, zero,
right.
Zero.
Now, at that point, I have to tell you, Art, we were not in this thing for the money. I mean, we've never really been in it for the money, because with the kind of work that's involved here, you could make three films. So it wasn't like we were holding out for a better deal. I didn't want to sign the contract because the film was 90% in the can, and I didn't see any reason to allow anybody
take editorial content.
That's right, because I was afraid that it would wind up another Geraldo's vault, where they would not use the stuff in the pyramid, the sonic stuff, or any of that good stuff, and it would just become a treasure hunt. So I wouldn't sign the
call toll-free 1-800-618-8255.
And basically, you know, sell out, I guess, my other investors. At the time, I probably should have thought a lot more about it than I did. But I just said no, and that was the end of that. And I figured, well, it's a disagreement between two associates.
So let's just say he allegedly made some offers to you to try to get you to go ahead with this deal.
That's right.
All right.
And I wouldn't do it because, again, there wasn't that much money in it. It wasn't that big a bonanza anyway. And we were so close to the truth that I couldn't see any reason, any justification for not keeping control of what we said.
So you said, no way.
I'm not signing this contract.
All right.
And we went in February on that, under those circumstances. What I did not know was that Shore's permit had been canceled.
You still at that point didn't know?
I didn't know that. That was before we went down in the well. This occurred a week before we went over, when we made our famous descent into the well and discovered the sarcophagus.
All right.
So now, apparently what Shore had told the Egyptians, and I can only surmise this, was that we had to come over because we had a deal with Fox and we had to finish the film.
All right. On that note, stop right there. We'll take a good break and we'll be right back. All right? All right. Bora Said is my guest. You're hearing the inside story of the Shore expedition, what they hope to find, how it all fell apart, and we'll talk about where we go from here, and we'll back up a little bit when we come back, because I've got a surprise for Boris. From the high deserts. No pyramids here that I know about, but you never really know what may lie under the ground. You know, all those mounds. This is Coast to Coast AM, and we will be right back.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from September 22nd, 1997.
Can't stay alive without your love.
Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from September 22nd, 1997.
Well, good morning. My guest is Boris Said, and I say an expert on the pyramids, telling us the story of the Shore Expedition. Quite a story it is, and his split with the Shore Expedition. And we're talking about the pyramids, what they are, what they might be. We'll get back to them in a moment. Coming up this week, folks, for those of you just joining this hour, aside from Boris tonight on the pyramids, tomorrow night, David John Oates, reverse speech on Mark Furman, Theron Mohammed, the Queen on Princess Di, the Area 51 calls, and Bill Clinton. Coming Wednesday, Professor Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics at New York University. Thursday night, Friday morning, Guy Finley on quickening-like topics. And then Friday, September 26th, this will be the last interview he'll do in a long time, Bob Lazar, a physicist who claims to have worked at Area 51 back engineering craft said to be at Area 51. So it's going to be quite a week, and then I will be in Egypt and elsewhere. And we'll get back to the subject of Egypt in a moment. All kinds of things up on the website for you to see. The pictures that we are discussing tonight with Boris are there. There is a new ghost photograph that'll knock your socks off that's there, and I don't post many ghost photographs. Take a look at it, please, and let me know what you think. There are photographs of a chupacabra made up of garden tools, which is one of the more innovative things I've ever seen in my whole life. My wife's photograph with all her awards, and many more things. The rogue market, of course, my stock is now going through the roof, headed toward 10,000. If you want to get part of it and be part of it, go to, again, my website, which I'll give in a moment, at www.artbell.com. Didn't even take a moment. And go to the rogue market and buy some Art Bell stock. Why? Because if you buy now, by the end of the week, you are going to be rich, rich, rich. We have had 2 hours of fascinating insight into the pyramids, into Boris Said's involvement with the pyramids, into his involvement with Zahi Hawass, and then the Shore Expedition. At the beginning of the discussion, we speculated about what the pyramids might be. And Boris Said, like myself, thinks they may, in effect, be a Stargate. I just got this fax. Art, did you have a chance to read Project Gateway to Orion's, an analysis of the Orion Pyramid Theory? I sent it to you about 2 weeks ago via priority mail. Boris said he wasn't sure when the pyramids were built. Well, the research Larry Hunter and myself have done shows the Orion Complex, the Giza pyramids, and the surrounding pyramids must have been built prior to the Fourth Dynasty. Now, Project Gateway to Orion, that sounds an awful lot like a Stargate, doesn't it, Boris?
Yes, it sure does.
I just happened to have on the phone with me Alex Michael Knott from Project Gateway to Orion, I guess the American Anthropological Research Foundation. Are you there, Alex?
I am. Hi, Art. How you doing?
I'm fine. That is what you believe the pyramids may be, is a Stargate?
Well, that isn't exactly what our research pertains to, although there are certain people who, within our product, who do hold those beliefs. What we're doing with Project Gateway to Orion is trying to get a better understanding of the topographical representations of celestial bodies. So, what Bavall did in the Orion Mystery is he correlated the three pyramids of Giza to the three belt stars in the constellation of Orion. So now what Larry Hunter, my research associate, partner, realized he's a navigator. And by taking global positioning satellite system positions on the tops of each of the three pyramids, he was able to superimpose a map of the Giza, marking the latitude and longitude, onto a map of the celestial sphere. So the celestial sphere is broken up into right ascension and declination. And if you were to get the positions of those stars on that grid and superimpose it onto the latitude and longitude, you could predict latitudinally and longitudinally where the other stars in the constellation would fall. Now, this is what Bouval tried to do in the Orion mystery, but he wasn't quite as scientific about it, and he made an error that was discovered by Mr. Hunter when he initially did his research. And what he discovered, and I think Boris would be familiar with this, is that Bouval assigned the Zaleop-Alarion pyramid to the star Bellatrix. And then he assigned, which would be a shoulder star. It would be the Orion from Earth's perspective. It would be Orion's right shoulder. And then there's another pyramid at Abu Ruwash. And Bouval wrote that that correlated the star Safe. But lo and behold, after Mr. Hunter did his research, he realized that actually Robert Bouval had it skewed, and that rather than Bellatrix correlating to Zaleop-Alarion and Safe to Abu Ruwash, if you swivel it so that the other shoulder star, which is Betelgeuse, and the other knee star, which is Rigel, correlates to those particular pyramids, then everything falls just beautifully. It works out perfectly. And
yes, but if not, then a stargate, toward what end?
Well, this would be, I think, an expression of the mythos, which has Geb and Nut, this is ancient Egyptian mythology, as the star, the sky goddess was Nut, and Geb was the god of land, and what had happened was their intercourse was interrupted by the god Shu.
All right, but you're ascribing this to mythos, and indeed, Boris does not think it's all myth. He thinks there's hard science.
I think the myth sprang out of the science,
yeah,
rather than the other way around.
I wouldn't disagree with you. I think that the myth came from probably an early civilization's attempts to make sense of what they were observing.
Well, are you aware, and I'm sure you've been listening, with regard to the frequency studies inside the Great Pyramid and the frequency of our very own Earth?
It's fascinating. We've found what I consider pretty hard evidence that the pyramid complex, the Orion complex itself as a unit, not just individual pyramids, were built prior to the Fourth Dynasty. And I'm being conservative. I'm not going too far back. But you know, there's good evidence that we're ready to reveal and disclose to the public through our project.
All right. Well, I've got on my studio cam right now, I've got a picture of your project, Gateway to Orion. Well, it's not a book yet. I guess it's very well done. It's in a different form. It's in a pre-book form. And so they can go up there and see that. I want to thank you for calling or allowing me to call you in, Alex, for just a moment. And thank you very much. And so there you are, Boris. What the work he's doing, it seems to me, though he ascribes it to mythology, really underscores what you believe to be true about the pyramids if you remove the myth part from what he has discovered.
Exactly. I mean, I don't pretend to be able to understand what he just said. I'm a humble documentarian here, and it's over my head, but what I think we have to encourage is an open discussion of this sort of thing. And the reason, again, the reason I was silent for 2 years was because I promised Dr. Shore I'd be silent when it became apparent to me that he was intent on sitting on the information and keeping it proprietary is when I went public, because I believe that we should all know about this. That's why I'm doing this. I'm doing this work because I believe this is information that if there are enough guys out there, like the gentleman who just called and Larry Hunter and Dick Hoagland and all of the people in Bouval who are studying this thing, maybe somewhere there's an answer that's a practical answer to this cliff we seem to be running towards as a society.
Mm-hmm.
It's maybe there's some solution there. There's some out there. And that's why I'm doing it. The horror of these situations is that in order to do a network show, it takes so much money that you always wind up with somebody like a Dr. Shore who has the preponderance of the money in and therefore ultimately can control the project. The punchline to all the stuff I've been telling you was that when we came back from Egypt and I wanted to basically confront the Antiquities Committee with what we'd found down in that well, and of course Dr. Shore didn't want to because his permit had been canceled, we had quite a falling out, and he demanded his film back, which he can legally do. Of course, I have an absolute, unrestricted and total and exclusive right to market and sell. So it's your classic cut the baby in half. You can have the film, but there's not much you can do with it, and there's nothing I can do with it.
So right now it just sits. Nobody can see it. Nobody can use it.
Well, here's what I want to do, and it's one of the reasons that I agreed to come on. You know, I mean, Art, you've been at the forefront in this thing, and a lot of people listen to you. 15 million people listen to you.
Mm-hmm.
I have, for the last 6 weeks since this problem started with Dr. Shore, have had two friends who are cameramen who've been prowling around the plateau with small digital cameras. And they have, in fact, been reshooting a lot of the stuff that we captured network quality with Betacam and 16-millimeter Aeroflex.
Under your auspices.
What's that?
Under your auspices.
Under their own auspices at the moment, because my situation with Dr. Shore until a week ago was quite muddy, and I wasn't quite sure where we were going to be, but I didn't want this information to die. And while it was summertime in the doldrums in Egypt, these guys, being Egyptian, prowled around over there. They have been up over the King's Chamber and have filmed that passageway that was the subject of Dick Hoagland's conversation with you.
All right. He, by the way, submits the following question, Boris. Dick Hoagland does.
Okay.
He says, describe the video you shot of Hawass's secret tunneling above the King's Chamber in the pyramid in November of 96.
Okay, I want to qualify this. Richard and I are good friends, and I have never believed that I've always believed that if that was in fact a secret tunnel, why in the world would they give me permission to drag a film crew up there? As I say, when I asked for permission to go up and film those rooms, nobody said, no, it's too dangerous, or no, you can't go, or no, it's off limits. They said, sure, you know, you pay your $700 or whatever it is, and up you go.
Mm-hmm.
We, in taking our crew up there, and I have since, this has been reshot on High 8, which is what we're coming to here, but on the first level above the King's Chamber, there are four sort of flat chambers. When I say flat, they're about 4 feet high.
Mm-hmm.
They're somewhat larger in area than the King's Chamber. And they look more like spaces and baffles in a speaker than they do like chambers. And then the fifth chamber, Lady Campbell's chamber, I believe it's called, is domed, is peaked. It has a peaked roof. And that's where the famous red cartouche is ascribed to, which ascribes the pyramid to Khufu, the famous sort of fake cartouche.
Mm-hmm.
In any event, we went up there, and on the first level, running from east to west, let me get this right, running a little bit south of west, was a new tunnel which was being cut parallel to that chamber. I couldn't imagine for the life of me why they were going parallel to the chamber, why they didn't just go down the end of the chamber and start there. But in any event, and that tunnel in the three trips I made to those rooms got progressively longer. The stuff they were carving out, the stones and stuff, when we were there originally in the spring of 1996, they were bagging the refuse, the stone and stuff, and they were storing it in the second chamber. In other words, they were hauling it up a level and storing it in the second chamber, which I thought was bizarre, but anyway. And then apparently, recently, they've been removing it. Over the last year, they've progressed to where there is now a 220 wire going up the wall from the King's Chamber, from the entrance to the King's Chamber, up into this area where they're digging the tunnel.
I've got documentation of that from Larry Hunter. I've got photographs of that cable.
Okay.
They also turned a security camera around to the wall.
Uh-huh. Well, okay. I got to tell you that Dr. Hawaz has never given me an idea that there was something up there I shouldn't shoot. And so I questioned the whole conspiracy and secrecy theory, and that's something Richard and I have always argued about. But I can only tell you that, yes, it's true, I have got footage. And what I am proposing to do is summarize what we've been talking about tonight.
All right.
And I'm next week going to be editing together a 45-minute documentary, which will not be a network documentary. We're going to do it with Hi8 and digital footage, and it will not be a network quality show. You know, Charlton Heston is not going to be the narrator. It'll be professional voice. And it will basically be a summary of what I've learned in Egypt in the last 2 years of this expedition with a little of the stuff from the West expedition.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to raise some money to carry this project on. I'm trying to raise the money to go back and reshoot some of this footage professionally and somehow get this thing on the air in spite of Dr. Shore and his millions. And what I'm hoping to be able to do is make this tape available. I'd like to make it available to your listeners. Basically for a donation, we have a shipping and handling and production cost that runs to about $9. I mean, it will cost me about $9 a tape to make the tape, duplicate it, and get it shipped out. So any donation in excess of that anybody cares to make would go to a wonderful cause, and I will be sending out these tapes within 30 days.
All right, we will tell people how to get involved with that in a moment. Stand by. It's the bottom of the hour. We'll be right back. Boris Said is my guest, telling you now what he has been unable to tell you for 2 years. All about the pyramids. Boris Said, right back.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from September 22nd, 1997. Somewhere in Time, tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from September 22nd, 1997.
My guest is Boris Said this morning. We're discussing Egypt, the pyramids, the Sphinx, the Shore Expedition, and it's kind of a case of finally speaking out after a lot of people have tried to interview Boris for 2 years, and he held all of this confidential and didn't talk to anybody. Tonight, he is. Back now to Boris Said. And Boris, if I understand everything correctly, in frustration over Mr. Shore having part of this and you having part of this and not being able to get it out to the American people, you're going to do, in essence, an end run around Shore, and you're going to produce this video independently and distribute it.
That's right. It's not going to be a network quality show. There's not the money for that. But what I'm trying to do is establish two things here. As I say, I've been at this now since 1991, and it wasn't the easiest thing in the world getting the mysteries of the Sphinx on the air, because a lot of people were not thrilled with the idea that there might have been an earlier date and therefore an earlier civilization. But it occurs to me, if you've got 15 million listeners, and we should find some focal point for them, and we could create ultimately a data bank, a list of interested people who want to support this sort of expedition. There are a lot of things we can do. We've got a 13-show series in the works now that we're talking to one of the cable networks about. We're going to be seeking some investment for that. We're going to be taking people from a list. We've got a whole group of people that are anxious to go on these expeditions, and they do everything from haul boxes to haul lights, and some are investors, and some just come along.
Mm-hmm.
My thought was that if there's a group of people out there that want to see what I've been talking about in Egypt, I'm going to put it on high eight. I'm going to put it on a good, professionally done but not network quality 45-minute tape that will have pictures of that sarcophagus, pictures of the well, pictures of the tunnel up over the Sphinx, and all of the stuff we've been talking about. We're producing it independently now. We couldn't up until like last week. We didn't know where we were with Dr. Shore, and we're still not 100% sure where we are, but we know that the footage is lost to us.
Basically, to lay things out for people, there is this existing footage shot under the Shore auspices.
Yes.
That you shot, I guess there are lawsuits and counter-lawsuits, and this thing is going to be hung up forever, and the baby's going to get torn in half. Nobody
exactly.
can use either half, so here you go around all of it and try to produce it anyway, and you are then soliciting people who are interested in supporting you in this effort.
In the home market.
And, all right, fine.
I'm making this pledge that every penny that we take in will go towards the production of this tape and getting into that room one way and another in Egypt. We are working on a not-for-profit foundation, but I think it's a long time in the doing, and it's quite expensive to do. So what I'd like to do is break it up into bite-sized chunks. I'd like to just solicit donations from people, in return for which I'm going to send them this tape.
All right. How do they contact you?
Okay. They can either contact me, Boris Said, S-A-I-D, or my company, Magical Eye Incorporated, Magical Eye, Inc.,
all right. So you're soliciting just donations at this point.
I'm soliciting donations. I'm putting it out there that the shipping and handling is about $5, and the cost of actually producing the tape, our cost is about $4. So, you know, if people can part with $20 or more, hallelujah. I mean, whatever they can send us will go towards this project, and I will establish a list. I would like to have a newsletter. I would like to feel that we can get a newsletter out. I would like to feel ultimately we'll have a website. I'd like to feel that we could put together a group of interested people, people who would like to get this information out there, and people who would like to support guys like Larry Hunter and Richard Hoagland and the people that are doing this kind of work, so that when we do have trips or we have investment opportunities, as in a specific network project or something, we'd have a list of people to go to and say, hey, you seem to be interested. Would you like to be involved?
Sure.
I don't know any other way to do it. I don't know any other way that we're ever going to combat the big money interest, the people that are stifling this information, other than a whole bunch of little people banding together.
Now, you told me that the deal with Fox fell through because you weren't about to sign a contract turning over creative and content to Fox.
I have the operative paragraph pinned to my wall here.
Really?
It says, Fox shall have complete prior business and creative control and approval over all elements of each program ordered hereunder, including without limitation. The script development, the material, all versions thereof, titles of the program, casting, producer, director, composer, host, writer, story editor, replacements for any such personnel, music, use and selection of film clips, still photographs, and it goes on for a paragraph.
My God. So they were taking it all, and this was of something that you had already 90% finished the shooting on.
The only thing we didn't have was the host.
The host, all right. Well, that, I guess, would have been easy.
Well, I mean, the host would have been, it was a question of which network we went with. Fox didn't want Heston, NBC wanted Heston. Fox didn't tell us who they wanted.
Gee, who wouldn't want Heston? That's crazy.
Fox didn't want Heston. He wasn't their image.
I see. All right. So anyway, so look, it wasn't going to get done by Fox. You then, before you gave up on all this, and you're on my show tonight, you went to another network, right?
Yes, we did. And the other network basically was interested, and I'll tell you how that played out. On August, I think, 14th, but I may be wrong on the date, I went down to Virginia Beach to the Edgar Cayce Foundation, where Dr. Hawaz and Dr. Shore were speaking.
That was the ARE conference.
Yes. And I confronted Dr. Hawaz, and I said, look, I've got to deal with a major network. They're interested if you will help us open this tunnel. And he said, what if the tunnel is empty, or what if there's no tunnel? I said, Zahi, I'll take that chance. It doesn't matter. If you'll go down there and dig and allow us to film it, I believe that we can put a show on that will be very good for Egypt, and it'll put all these rumors to rest once and for all. He said to me in front of three witnesses, Boris, if you and Dr. Shore can resolve your differences, I'll help you.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Shore was not interested in talking. Dr. Hawaz tried him. He called me up. He said, you know, Dr. Shore doesn't want to talk about it. He feels the thing is his. He wants you to get out of the project.
Oh.
Now, I don't know how true that is. I don't know at first hand if that happened, but I can tell you that Zahi Hawaz, for all of what people say about him, has always been very fair with me.
Well, I want to say something about that, too. Everybody had me scared of Dr. Hawaz. I had done a number of shows with Bivol and Hancock, and, of course, Richard, and I was almost scared of Dr. Hawass. Certainly freaked out to go over to Egypt. I thought, man, I'm not coming out of there alive. And then one day, I received an autographed copy of a picture of Dr. Hawass in a frame. And I thought, oh my God! It's like waking up with a horse head next to you in bed, you know. And it said, "Thanks for all your help, Art." And I'm thinking, oh man, I'm in deep stuff here.
I love it.
But actually, then I had an interview set up with Dr. Hawaz, and the other day, oh, I don't know, a week or so ago, Dr. Hawaz, I called Dr. Hawaz. He said, "I'll tell you what, let's cancel this interview. You'll be in Egypt October 4th, come to my office when you get to Egypt, and I'll take you anywhere you want to go. Now, I've got lots of choices. I could go up above the King's Chamber and take a look at all of that, supposedly secret, or I could go, I suppose, I asked you where I ought to ask him to go, and you said, down into the well.
I would go down. I think you find the well fascinating. That trip up to those chambers is a hairy expedition, let me tell you.
So my, I'll bear that in mind, thank you. So my impression of Dr. Hawass is certainly changed, and he seems very, very open to me.
Well, he's open to me, too. I don't know where he got this rap. As I say, all I ever heard about Dr. Hawaz was from John West, and he and John have a grudge that go back a long way, I guess.
Well, I guess there was a little something that I heard. Maybe you can confirm this or deny it, Boris. Regarding Bivol and Hancock, there was something about Dr. Hawaz allegedly saying that if they showed up at Giza, he would have them thrown in a deep pit, beheaded, and I think you may know the rest of the quote.
Yes, I do. I know it intimately. look, when I got down to Virginia Beach, I walked into a hotel which will remain nameless, and there was a table, a round table, at which sat Dr. Shore, Dr. Jehoda, Zahi Hawaz, Robert Bivol and his wife, and a couple of other people, and they all seemed cordial enough to me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've known Zahi a long time. I'm sure Zahi has a temper. We all do. So do I. But I absolutely would never believe that story, because that's just not the kind of thing he would say. In my knowledge of the man, I mean, I don't think there's any love lost there, you know. I don't think he's a big fan of Bivol. I don't think he's a big fan, for that matter, of what we're doing. But I've never known him to be anything but fair. And that's not a self-serving statement. The guy's been fair to me. And, you know, that's the truth of it.
Well, when I talked to Dr. Hawaz, he said, "You're an interesting man, Mr. Bell, and I hear every word you utter in Egypt."
Well, I'm sure of that. I can tell you this about Zahi on a personal note. He got a girl a job working for my company. When one of our employees had to go home early and we were short a production assistant, and he sent a girl for an interview, and she's my wife today.
Oh.
So
Dr. Hawass introduced you to your wife then.
That's right. That's right.
Well, you all big time then.
I don't think that's what he had in mind. It happened. But we've laughed about it. I consider Zahi a friend. We started off on the wrong foot, and we patched it up. And I tell you, you know, with all these stories about conspiracies and things, I have never seen any evidence of it.
Well, the big rap against Dr. Hawass, and I'll give it to you unless you comment, and you can dodge it if you want.
Okay.
But the comment is, or the myth perhaps is, that Dr. Hawass will allow teams to come over, the Shore team, the University of Florida folks, and others, and do a lot of hard work with X-ray, with ultrasound, all the rest of it, and identify interesting areas to probe, and then just when it gets to the point where they're ready to actually do a dig or confirm what they've found through X-ray or ultrasound, then Hawass says, see you later, you're out of here, and proceeds himself. That's the rap. Now,
well, I tell you what. I know that that's the rap, okay? And I am not going to dodge the question. I'm looking for a correct way to answer it. I'd say this to you. Certainly, I don't know. A lot of this started when Gantenbrink sent his camera up into that little room and
yes.
found that thing, and then Gantenbrink got thrown out. I don't know Gantenbrink. I understand, and I understood this from Bavall, that he was not the easiest guy in the world to get along with, and there was a lot of ego there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there is without question a lot of ego in Egypt. I used to say that Egypt should have been named Ego-Gypt or something like that.
Ego-Gypt.
It is without question, there are a lot of agendas on that plateau.
Mm-hmm.
I would not deny that. But I don't think that Dr. Hawass is basically deliberately sort of allowing people to spend their money and then throwing them out. I just don't think that's accurate.
All right.
I think people may run afoul of them. I think that problems may occur, just as happened with Shore. I don't know why our permit was canceled.
All right, well, let's ask this question. Now, look, the pyramids are in Egypt. Egypt is a sovereign nation. One argument says that we're a bunch of meddling outsiders who have no right demanding to do anything at all inside the sovereign nation of Egypt. It's theirs. The other argument says the pyramids belong to the world. The information that may be there belongs to the world. It's much bigger than any nation's individual sovereignty. Which argument do you favor?
I believe that Egypt is that the monuments are sovereign to Egypt, and I believe that they have over the years been ripped off by foreign archaeologists who had the money and the know-how to mount the expeditions and take all the artifacts. All the artifacts of Egypt are in the British Museum and the Louvre and all over the world. But I do believe that it's a legacy for the world, and I don't think the Egyptians would deny that. And my problem is that I haven't seen, since I started in Egypt, a single one of these expeditions that went to the Antiquities Department and said to them, look, we'd like to work with you on this. We'd like you to name a team of Egyptian archaeologists to work with our scientists to develop some theories about the Sphinx.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly John West didn't do that, and most certainly neither did Dr. Shore. I'm the documentarian, but that's what I would have done. And when I went to Dr. Hawass, when this whole thing came apart in February, and I said, look, Zahi, why don't you open the tunnel and just let us film it, and we'll give Dr. Shore credit, you know, for the scientific work that he did.
Right.
And Zahi was quite receptive to that idea.
All right.
Now, you know, if I come out to Nevada and I'm a delegation from the sovereign nation of Turkey, for instance, and I walk in and say I'm going to dig here, and you guys just stand back out of the way, you know, I think we find it ours. I wonder how it would be received.
Not real well.
Exactly. So I think that both things are true. I'm not trying to dodge the question, but I think, yes, it is a sovereign nation, and it's the stuff is theirs. And it's their history and their background and their ethos that we're dealing with. Yes, I think that it belongs to the world, and I have not seen a single instance of the government standing in the way of a legitimate effort to bring this stuff to the world. What happens is that the people that mount these expeditions, as happened with Dr. Shore, as I think happened with the John West expedition, is the egos get involved.
All right, let me take you back to the Shore expedition. How much interest did Dr. Shore show on items inside the Great Pyramid as opposed to outside, you know, the Sphinx, the tunnel and chamber and so forth?
Not much.
I had to
basically badger him into bringing Danley over, and Danley was not even paid an honorarium. He came basically because I begged him to.
You must have discussed this with Dr. Shore. Why so little interest?
Well, because Dr. Shore is, I believe, interested in one thing and one thing only, and that's discovering, and that's proving that Edgar Cayce was right and that there is a chamber under the Sphinx. I think he's obsessed with it. And I think that whatever the man's inconsistencies have been, they're due to the fact that he is obsessive about getting into that room.
Mm-hmm. Do you think he... Now, you're going down one road with us tonight in what you want to proceed with. Now, what do you think Dr. Shore will do? I'm asking you to speculate, but if he is obsessive with regard to trying to get to the secret chamber, how do you think he will proceed?
I think that he will go to Dr. Hawaz and say, all right, I've gotten rid of Boris, and now we're going to go to the room. And it's a hard question for me to answer, because I think what he did is irrational. I think that we have this thing, you know, swimming towards the boat, as they say, and then, you know, it became a question of who was the boss and who was in charge of what. And, you know, was I acting without his permission, and did I need his permission in the film and so forth? And it became a struggle of will, and I said, look, you know, I'm not working for you. I'm making a film. And in the end, I have a responsibility to my shareholders to make a successful film. So what do I think he's going to do? I don't know. I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to try and get this news out to as many people as will.
Well, one thing he might try to do is go to Dr. Hawass and have you cut off.
Well, yes, he can. He can certainly try and do that. You know, and will Zahi do it? I don't think so. I think Zahi will say, you guys settle your own problems. Because I'm going to do whatever the court suggests I do. And yes, I may get cut off, but I believe this. I think if I can get several thousand of these tapes out there, and among the several thousand people who buy them, there are a couple of editors, or there's some people who have influence with a senator, or there are some people who would like to seriously get interested in this thing, I think we can put a team together and go to Egypt and sit down with Zahi and say, look, this is going to be good for Egypt. We want you to open the tunnel. We want you to do the work. We'll give you the rights to Egypt for nothing. We'll give you the cassettes in Egypt for nothing.
All right, listen, we're at the top of the hour. What I would like to do is open the phone lines, let people ask questions.
Great.
Would you be willing?
Absolutely.
All right, then that's coming up next. Stand by. Interesting, huh? I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from September 22nd, 1997.
Sweet surprise. Her hands are never cold. She's got better days inside. She'll turn the music on. You won't have to think twice.
Somewhere in Time on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from September 22nd, 1997.
My guest is Boris Said. If you have questions about the pyramids, this is going to be your night. He'll be up in a moment to answer your questions, and I'll give you the rest of the phone numbers as well. After 2 years of absolute silence, Boris Said has spoken out. Now, we're about to go to the lines, but Boris, I've got this question for you. Now that you've gone public, Dr. Shore is probably going to react in some manner.
I'm sure.
Unknown for sure. But suppose Dr. Shore were to call me up and say, look, I want an opportunity to speak out publicly. Would you be interested in speaking with Dr. Shore publicly?
You bet.
Oh, you would?
I've got nothing whatever to hide here. I've got nothing to gain and nothing to hide, and the only thing that we can lose here is a lot of precious information. I respected Dr. Shore's confidence for 2 years, and until he pulled the rug out from under me and tried to overwhelm me with dollars and a high-priced firm of attorneys and the whole rest of it, I kept the peace, and I didn't speak out at all. I never said a word. When I saw this thing basically going into a closet forever, I'm sitting here looking at an order from a judge saying the next hearing on this issue will be in March of 1998. The next hearing will be March of 1998.
So it could go years.
It could go years.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I think that is unconscionable. I think that's a disservice to certainly to all the people that have supported me. Art, I've got psychics and mystics and teachers and gurus and friends who have supported this thing from the very beginning, and they all of them said to me, why don't you go public? Why don't you go out there and see if there are little people out there someplace that want to help? And that's why I haven't put a price on the tape. I mean, the tape is priceless. I mean, how much is it? $19, $39? It's whatever people want to send me to help continue this work.
All right. Let's go to the phones. First time caller line, you're on the air with Boris Said. Hello.
Greetings, Art and Boris.
Hi there.
Where are you,
how are
sir?
You?
Where are you?
I'm in cyberspace, also known as Baltimore.
Oh, all right.
And, by the way, I listen to the show every night. There's not a darn station in town that I can get anything of reception from you with, and it's just great to have the Internet to do that.
Well, there will be shortly.
I certainly hope so. Maybe BAL, something like
yeah.
that. So, Mr. Said, you really are my kind of guy. Just wanted to let you know I'm sending Art an email, and I'll be corresponding with you. I want to contribute some webmaster services to get you a big website going with everything that you're doing.
There's a good idea, Boris. You do need a website.
Yes.
And that is my business, and we'll be able to incorporate video and audio. Ironically, I've been building a 3D multi-user virtual reality model of Giza. And it'll be interesting. We'll be able to have people, explore, walk up, meet each other, and discuss the issues together, simultaneously.
Well, it's an area I know nothing about.
Perhaps, and we'll get going with that.
Okay.
Just a brief sarcophagus story, perhaps. When I was 15, I went to Israel, and when I was there, we played a game of hide-and-seek. They sent me down into this deep cave in this coastal city. Lo and behold, I found myself surrounded by these sterling white sarcophagi, and I climbed into one, and strangely enough, it seemed to be a perfect fit, and after a few moments, I seemed to slip into some kind of altered state of consciousness that I came out of several minutes later when they came and found me. But, that story that you told about the sarcophagus and laying inside of it, definitely rings true. And I think there's something very solid about that, and I think people can maybe look for those sorts of experiences in their own lives and see what they get out of that.
But
I certainly hope we can correspond, and any video and other audio that we do you do have, we can send that out streaming over the internet, and we'll be able to get it in front of a lot of people, and maybe we'll we won't spam, but we'll maybe target some senators and some people that you'd like to get in front of.
Fantastic. Now, did you get my address? Can you send me the information? And then
I certainly will. And I'll be sending an email to Art, and maybe he can get you my phone number that way as well, and we can converse.
All right. Done deal. My email address is artbell@aol.com. And while we're at it, Boris, give your address again.
Okay. My address is 1906 Smuggler's Hill. And that's in Friday Harbor,
Washington, 98250.
All right, and we'll get that out yet again, so everybody get your pencils and papers ready. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Boris Saeed. Hello.
Good morning, Art. Hello, Mr. Saeed.
Hi there.
Is Kathy in Reno. Sir, your efforts are highly commendable.
Thank you.
All righty. I have two question comments. Here we go. In understanding the nature of your experience in the pyramid on that rainy night,
yes.
In essence, you physically bilocated. Okay. Possibly their access to eternal life was this bilocation process, holding the life energy or soul in the secondary position long enough for the physical body in the pyramid to cease its life function and die. The soul now physically bilocated would no longer be subject to the aging process, theoretically, I think.
Okay.
And my last thing, and thank you, Art, for the time. The process of the pyramid's construction, specifically the method used to transport that many stones of such enormous size, has got to be a method unknown to us because...
Because we can't duplicate it.
Well, also during their transport, they would have made, had they been transported across land, they would have made grooves and roads that would still be visible to us to this day, I would think.
All right. Well, I remember, as most of you must, the Ten Commandments where gazillions of slaves were being whipped and these giant stones were being moved with rollers and all the rest of it. You don't think that's the way it happened, Boris?
I have an apartment in Egypt with a view of the pyramid, and I had 9 wonderful, industrious Egyptian workers in that 5-room apartment one day working. And I'll tell you categorically that if there had been 10, it would have been a catastrophe. So the thought of thousands of people hooked to one block, all pulling at the same time, it just didn't happen.
And then even if you can imagine that occurring... and I remember in the Ten Commandments, slaves getting rolled under the stones and all the rest of it. But then once they got it there, they never did bother to quite show us how they got it up there.
That's right. And the question I want to know is why. Why would they build with stones that size? Why would they set themselves that sort of a task? Why are the temples in front of the Sphinx built with 200-ton stones? What were they defending against?
I don't know. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Boris Saeed. Hello.
Boris.
Yes.
Good morning. How you doing?
Where are you, sir?
I'm here in Georgia.
Georgia, all right.
Yes, and if I'd like to use my email name, I would greatly appreciate it.
No, I'd rather you don't.
All right, let me just give you my initials, T.L. Is that good enough?
Fine.
All right, Boris, remember
yes.
when you was down in the tomb, they wanted you to sign a piece of paper of secrecy, right?
Yes.
The majority of the information is controlled by the order of the Essence and the Knights Templar. Certain information is not supposed to be given out to the public.
I don't think that's the kind of secrecy agreement he had to sign.
No, I signed a secrecy agreement with Dr. Shore.
Right.
So that he could keep the information proprietary.
Right, because he's bound. If you go across the Nile to the Dagon tribe, they give you more information on the pyramids.
All right, well, what do you think about that, Boris? There is this old... this is the road that Richard travels down.
Yes.
The Masons, the Knights Templar, all the rest of it. Secret orders and societies, and of course Richard believes that a lot of the discoveries in Egypt have precisely driven the NASA program. How do you react to all of that?
I don't know. I haven't got the information necessary to refute all that stuff, but I have to tell you that this whole conspiracy thing, this whole idea of secrecy, my question is why? If there was an advanced society and they could do amazing things and transcend dimensions and do all the things that Michio is going to talk about on Wednesday, why would there be secrecy? Why is there this kind of religious cabal that prevents us from expanding our awareness of the universe we live in? I just don't buy that.
Well, let's for a second again talk about the Hall of Records. Let us assume for the sake of conversation there is a Hall of Records beneath the Sphinx somewhere.
Yes.
In this chamber.
Right.
That tells us all about a previous, earlier civilization. Maybe even is some sort of last attempt on the part of that civilization to record what occurred so it might not occur again, because after all,
okay,
if there was a previous civilization, they're not around anymore.
That's right.
And so they might have tried to put a sort of a time capsule for the future to tell whoever might come next what not to do.
All right.
So if that's true, and if that's actually found by Egyptian authorities or by whoever, do you think that information really would immediately be made public? Or do you think that somebody would, you know, fold it far away? And
well, look what happened with the Dead Sea Scrolls. Look how long it was before that came to light.
Well, that's my point.
It was a scandal.
Yeah.
Now, what I feel is this, that if, in fact, there was a Hall of Records, if I were the Egyptian government and some guy with a seismograph had turned up a room 15 feet or 30 feet below the surface,
right,
in my plateau, and I knew absolutely for a fact that I could drill a high-speed diamond drill hole through limestone and find out what's in there without anybody being the wiser, I would do it. Now, they haven't done it, or they don't admit to doing it, or for whatever reason they're not giving out the information, but it is their plateau.
Do you think they've done it?
yes.
You
yeah,
do?
In a word, I think that they've been in that room. Now, is it the only room? Are there rooms under it? Is it the first of a labyrinth of rooms? I believe that's possible. But I believe that the room under the paw of the Sphinx has been entered.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, that's what I believe from the very beginning, simply because it's not that hidden art. It's not that obscure.
In that case, if there is a Hall of Records, it may now be an empty hall.
It may be, or it may be down two or three layers below. We had a very wonderful Israeli psychic there with us named Zev Coleman, and he felt that there were two layers, two strata of rooms below the room that we were identifying. And the problem with the seismic stuff is it only bounces back once. So you'd have to go down to the next level to find out what's at the level below it.
I'm glad I asked. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Boris Said. Hello, where are you?
I'm in Fresno. Name is David.
Hi, David.
Hi, David.
Good morning, Art, Mr. Said.
Hi there. Boris, please.
Okay, Boris. I'm just curious whether you were able to discern any markings on the sarcophagi lids or anywhere down in the well at all.
There were no markings whatsoever in the well.
As a matter of fact, caller, if you have a computer, we've got the photographs up there. You can go look at it.
I'm not on the web currently.
That lid that we found in the bottom of the well was a highly polished black granite sarcophagus lid. It was beveled. It was tapered. It looked exactly like those sarcophagus lids in the burial place of the bulls in Saqqara, where the bulls are buried.
Okay, I think I've seen something like that. Okay, I guess that's about all over here. I really support your work.
Thank you.
Keep it up. I'll help you any way I can.
I'd love to send you a tape.
Okay, good night.
All right, that's KFRE, of course, in Fresno. First time caller line, you're on the air with Boris Said. Hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
Hi there.
I just wanted to suggest if you write a book, you might want to name it...
Turn your radio off, please.
Okay, 1 second, please.
All right, everybody remember...
A little phone anyway.
Close, it's very confusing. Okay, there you go. Hello, caller?
Yeah, I'm here.
All right.
Oh, I forgot what I was going to say. I was just wondering... have you heard the Institute of Christian Research? Because they've been saying for decades that the further back you go in time, the more advanced civilization gets. And that is a Christian organization, so not all Christians would be shocked by this.
Most would. Most Christians believe, I think, that modern civilization is about 6,000 years old.
Mm. Well, that would be Usher's chronology. But I'm just saying the Institute for Christian Research, which believes in a 10,000-year time period, does say the further back you go in time, the more advanced the civilization gets.
Wow.
And the theory being, you know, God created us advanced to begin with, and we degraded.
Well, or something catastrophic came along. Boris, here's a good question for you. Somebody faxed and said, look, I don't think there was any previous civilization, and the reason I don't believe that is because there is no garbage. There's nothing left. Where are all the artifacts of this ancient civilization? Their modes of transportation, their buildings, whatever they might have had that was magnificent or large, where is it?
Well, maybe it's deeper.
Uh-huh.
We've only scratched the surface. Don't forget, there is a fossil of a sea urchin on the back of the Sphinx that was under seawater millions of years ago. Who knows how deep this stuff is buried? I mean, that's Mark Lehner's argument. Show me a pot shot. Show me one shred of an ancient civilization. But that's because we assume that ancient civilizations left that kind of garbage because that's what we leave.
You say there's a sea urchin?
So I've got a photograph of the fossil of a sea urchin on the rump of the Sphinx.
Wow!
And that's right next to where the Getty people had their weather barometer 3-4 years ago.
First time caller line, you're on the air with Boris Said. Hi.
Hi.
Where are you?
New Orleans.
New Orleans, all right.
Wow.
Yeah.
Mike, I have questions that are related to one another. If it is not a secret society that has been limiting access to the pyramids and the Sphinx, what are the delimiting factors, and does the notion of digging, is that a significant factor, and does that account for your decision to look at or examine what is out, available, and up on top of everything as far as your expedition? And how do you exactly intend to expand the types of eyes? And I'm talking about...
All right, well, one question at a time. Let's okay. Tackle them one at a time. The digging.
Okay, the digging, it is very complicated to get an excavation permit in Egypt. It has to be done through an institution of higher learning. It's very costly. It's very complicated. They're very, and understandably so, careful about their artifacts. And it's not a simple process to get the right to dig. That's one of the reasons why we went to a more sophisticated means of looking under the ground. Now, I didn't just decide to look above the ground because they wouldn't let me dig. I've just became convinced through my exposure over 9 years, and again, I have no PhDs. I'm not an educated person in any specific sense of the word in Egypt. But the experience of being there and being confronted with these things and examining the mathematics and the astronomy and the sonics and all of the different aspects of this, it's just become apparent that it's fascinating. And it's a lot more interesting to me than digging under the ground and finding some sort of a tablet that says, you know, this is what Atlantis was all about, which nobody's going to believe anyway for 20 years.
Then following to that question, if you are trying to involve persons who might have other views, have you considered the fact that even when you look at the stars, especially along the equator and where you're seeking to look is not that far, that there's almost millions of stars compared to what we might see in this hemisphere, and that there are different configurations, therefore the myth systems and the science would be different and growing out of a different conceptual framework?
I think it's certainly possible. As I say, I'm not the astronomer, and frankly, I've just read with great interest everything that's been written like this. I think Bavall's stuff is phenomenal and would have included it in our film if he had not had the break with Shore. And I think that there are so many different logical explanations for things about the pyramid that it's all the more reason to have a serious look at it with all of the scientific disciplines.
All right. Let's see if we can pick one up before the bottom of the hour. Wildcard line, you're on the air with Boris Said. Hello.
Hi, Art. This is Reed from New Orleans.
From where?
New Orleans.
New Orleans, yes, sir.
I had a quick question. I was watching a show on the Discovery Channel about 2 months ago. They had some kind of mechanical robot that was going up a shaft or something.
Oh, yes. Boris can tell you about that.
Well, that's I didn't actually see it, but a guy named Gantenbrink, a very brilliant German guy, invented a robotic device that took a camera up that air shaft and photographed a small door with hinges at the end of it.
And how has anybody yet opened that door?
No, not that I know of.
All right, they took a little fiber optic thing and tried to look in, didn't they?
Yes, and nobody knows what they saw underneath it. Now, Richard Hoagland believes that there's a room on the other side of it with a scribe sitting there, a statue of a scribe staring at Orion.
With a black man, I believe you said, with an ankh in his hand.
Right. My own feeling is that if Tom Danley is correct, and the pyramid is a giant sonic device, that perhaps that door was there so that if the pharaoh had too much or not enough or whatever, you could shut the door and turn off the vibration. I mean, that, to me...
That's an interesting theory, Boris.
Well, you can't see through the shaft, right? The shaft's got a bend in it, so you can't see the stars anyway.
So that would cut off the vibration.
Well, the point is that it certainly wasn't there to keep the rain out if the shaft is 8 inches square and
you're darn right.
Long.
Well, you're darn right. All right, Boris, hang tight. We'll be right back. Bottom of the hour. This is Coast to Coast.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight's an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from September 22nd, 1997. Somewhere in Time, on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from September 22nd, 1997.
Well, I'm here. And so is Boris Said, and ready for your questions in this next half hour. And we'll get back to him in a moment. All right, here we go once again. Boris, are you there?
I'm here, wide awake.
All right, and I take it you got to do an information exchange with the young lady we had on.
Yeah, I'm going to be on the phone to Jim Hertog tomorrow to tell him about those stones. It sounds fascinating.
All right.
This is exactly what I was hoping would happen, Art, is that we would connect some people who are interested and maybe give them a way to express some of this stuff. You know, I mean, she's in Mexico. She may be able to come to one of our expedition sites.
Exactly. All right, first time caller line. You're on the air with Boris Said. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I'm from Las Vegas. My name is Lou. And I would like to ask you if the information that you will discover will destroy the financial institutions around the world like money.
Hmm.
Would you release that information?
You know, that's a well. Actually, the question goes deeper. It's a good question, but the information that might be discovered, should they come upon the Hall of Records, would tip over so many paradigms, Boris, that I've always wondered if it really would ever get released.
Well, you know, here's the thing: we're living in the information age, right?
Right.
If we put together a group of people and we go over there and have an opening, which I think ultimately with enough pressure, enough people, can make this happen. And everybody's standing there, and Dr. Hawaz or whoever goes into that tunnel, and there's a camera looking over his shoulder, it's going to be hard put to keep that out of the press. I mean, the cameras are everywhere today, and the press is everywhere, and we're living in an electronic age where you can take a camera the size of your palm, the palm of your hand, and record images with it that you can broadcast around the world. I don't see how they're going to keep it secret.
You're darn right. As a matter of fact, when I go over there, I'll be there in a week, and actually October 4th up on Giza, and I'll have a high 8 with me. And I will take what I can, because Dr. Hawass is going to take myself and my wife on a tour, and when I get back, we'll compare notes.
Yeah, it'll be terrific. And you know, Carla, the thing about this that's as important is right now we're talking to maybe 15 million people or however many people are listening. I mean, never in history has that been possible. Never in history has that been possible.
That's
true. How are you going to keep it quiet?
Well, you can't.
You can't. Exactly right.
Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Boris Said. Good morning.
Good morning, Art, and good morning, Boris. How you doing?
Good morning, sir. I'm fine.
I got two questions. One referring to the recently discovered Japanese pyramids, and one, I'll just start with the first question. Boris, do you think when we finally get to Mars and reach the area, the face of Cydonia, we might just discover a city of petrified semi-extraterrestrial technology and machinery that may be tied directly or indirectly to our pyramids here?
Well, I certainly wouldn't say no to that. My friend Richard Hoagland believes very strongly in this, and he's put forward some extraordinary material. If you're asking me for a personal belief, yeah, I believe that's going to happen.
Okay.
It doesn't come from some educational background, but my gut instinct is that there's something to what Richard says.
All right.
Okay, interesting. And one more. What's with the low-key information distribution on the pyramids just recently discovered off the coast of Japan? If you have any information on that, I'd appreciate it.
All right. Indeed, off the coast of Japan, actually near Okinawa, the Ryukyu Islands, they have discovered underground pyramids.
I've heard about that. I can tell you that I'm planning to be in Japan this winter in connection with the Winter Olympic Games, and I'm going to go to a place called Moto Ise, where there is supposed to be a pyramid that's been camouflaged by trees and dirt, but apparently it is a pyramid. And I'm going to go and investigate that. And I just heard the story. I've heard it third hand, and I'm trying to get information. If you have anything on that, I'd love to have it.
I do. I do. You're going to want to contact Linda Moulton Howe, and I can supply you with a number off-air, Boris.
Okay, super.
She was just there and just did, we'll be doing a story this week on Dreamland on it.
Oh, super.
East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Boris Said. Hi.
Hello.
Hello. Where are you, sir?
I'm in Austin.
Texas, all right.
Yes, and I was wondering, I've heard about something, there's going to be an earthquake in Giza sometime before the spring, and it's supposed to break open the Sphinx and reveal the Hall of Records. And I was wondering if you could verify any of
that. Would be Edgar Casey, right?
Yes, I've heard the prediction. I can't say yes or no. There are a lot of predictions, and there certainly have been earthquakes there. I went through one, cracked the walls of my apartment a couple of years ago. So I wouldn't doubt that there could be an earthquake. I know there is a Casey prediction that says that's about to happen.
All right. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Boris Said. Hello.
Yes, Arden.
Yes.
Gentlemen, I have a couple statement and a question.
All right.
Is the Sphinx classified as possibly being a tomb?
No.
It's not?
I've never heard of it being a tomb. I've heard that it was I think the accepted Egyptological view is that it was a monument to glorify the name and memory of the pharaoh Khafre, of pharaoh Chephren, or Khafre.
But if this is the Sphinx was made before the flood, and you say it was underwater at one time, what would happen if you possibly got down in below the Sphinx somewhere and you come across a large giant size skeleton?
I think that it would astonish the world, and I don't think it's beyond the realm of possibility.
There's a possibility that might happen.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. That's all I wanted to say.
All right. Thank you very much. Yeah, you really can't rule that out, can you?
What's that?
You can't rule it out, Boris.
You can't rule anything out. I mean, that's the thing. You don't know what's under there. I know that when we first started doing the Sphinx, somebody asked me what I thought the Sphinx was. And I said, tongue-in-cheek, it later became a cartoon that went all over the United States. I said the Sphinx is a radiator ornament on a giant sports car. And then when they got done digging it up, they were going to have clamshell fenders and maybe a V-350 engine and footprints leading off in the direction of a gas station. But, I mean, who knows what it is, you know? I mean, we don't know what it is. There's 100 theories.
You're absolutely right, and we've heard just a few tonight.
I think the thing is to keep a bit of humor and to keep asking the questions and not to ridicule anybody.
East of the Rockies, you're on there with Boris Said. Where are you, please?
Good morning, Art. Chicago.
Yes, sir.
Good morning, Art, and good morning, Said.
Good morning, sir.
So
beautiful program, right? Really fantastic. I goosebumps all over. The Sphinx has been changed twice in the Second Dynasty, and I'd like to know if you got anything off the satellites. And another thing is, try to get a version of the Holy Quran by Yusuf Ali, 1949. I've studied that in the Dynasty, on the Dynasties and everything else, and you'll find a lot in there, if you can. I
by
had a version
Uli?
Of it. Pardon me?
By Uli?
No, Yusuf Ali.
Yusuf Ali, okay.
Right.
All right.
And look through there and study that, and you can get a lot of information out of that.
Okay.
All right, thank you for the good show. Saeed, thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Okay.
Right, take care. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Boris Saeed. Hello.
Hello, Boris.
Yes.
Hello, Art.
Hi. Where are you?
I'm calling from Aspen.
Aspen? Hey. Oh, Aspen, Colorado.
Yeah, actually, Glenwood Springs, down here a lot. And
all right.
I shuffle back and forth. Hey, first, I want to ask you both, how would you like to have every question you can possibly think of answered about the Great Pyramid? And I mean, when it was built, how it was built, why it was built.
I would like that.
How it pertains to all holy scriptures of all religions and the pyramids in Mexico and around the world, and actually answered in one day.
Okay.
I would invite you both to Aspen or Glenwood Springs to do just that. And I promise you, Art, that if either one of you were to do this, you would then want to have one of us on for a five-hour show.
Why don't you just tell us now?
Well, I can't answer them all in one short call. It's a very deep subject, but it's a very good subject, and it bears a lot of investigation.
You can't even give us a short version? I mean, to taunt us with all the answers?
Okay, are you aware of the displacement factor in the Great Pyramid?
Displacement.
I don't know what that means.
Okay. Well, when it was first broken into was about 720 AD by a Muslim. And he was just so many pyramid inches away from the doorway. And had he been, I think it's 286 pyramid inches to the right of where he broke in, he would have pushed on the right stone and found the door. Now, that 286 point some pyramid inches also pertains to the height of the pyramid, the number of days of gestation of a human embryo, and several other things, okay? And then if you take that, you can go out to Mount Sinai with it, that number of miles, and that number of miles in another direction takes you to the Jordan, right where it was crossed by the Israelites. Then you can take the Egyptian current and go right to the Yucatan, basically. There's so much stuff. The boats buried in the pits next to the Great Pyramid actually sailed to this country. The rock that the sarcophagus and the original capstone, which was found in a socket and is now in the Museum of Egypt in Cairo in a vault, were all made of the same of a type of stone that we've done a spectrographic analysis of, that can only be found quarried, and in that spectrographic specific type in Racine, Wisconsin.
All right, this
is just a smattering.
Quite right. This is obviously very complicated.
Really?
Right.
And so what I would recommend is that you contact Boris Saeed privately. Do you have any email address at all?
Do I?
Do you?
I will have in the next two or three days.
All right.
We're working
when
on
you
that.
Get it, Boris, get it to me, and we'll get it on our
website. I will get
website.
It to you, Art, as soon as I have it.
All right, good. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Boris Saeed. Hello.
Oh, thank you. I'm calling from Phoenix.
Yes.
Good conversation tonight. I wanted to know if you gentlemen were familiar with a man named Dr. Gene Scott.
Oh, yes.
Oh, okay. Have you ever had him on the show?
No, but I have watched Dr. Scott sit
uh-huh.
there hour after hour after hour.
Uh-huh. Have you seen him do the pyramid, his pyramid?
As a matter of fact, I have. I've even heard Dr. Scott discussing me.
Is that? Oh, I missed that one.
Oh, yes.
hopefully it was good.
Yeah, it was, actually.
Yeah, well, he's interesting. I just thought, I just wanted to make the comments about the pyramids. And also there's a man named Edward Leeds Scanlon, who's been dead for about 70 years now, who claimed to know how the pyramids were built. He built a coral castle. It's 20 miles south of Miami.
Oh, yeah, I've been there.
It is awesome.
Yes, it is.
It's a secret how he did it, but that's all I wanted to say.
That's good. No, that's a very good point. I'd love to have him on sometime. In the meantime, Carl Castle is an interesting question. Boris, any idea how he might have built Coral Castle?
None whatsoever. I know I once went down there and interviewed a guy in connection when we were doing the Sphinx show who claimed to have known him. He was a kind of a funny guy. He was blind drunk the whole time for the whole week I was there. Every time I saw him, he was seemed to be further into it. But he used to say that he'd go over and visit, I guess the guy's name was Dennison, and every time he'd visit him, the guy would stop work. And every time he'd come back, there'd be something else moved into place. But nobody that I know has any idea how he moved the stuff. He couldn't have moved it with the tools that are on display down there. It's just physically impossible.
So he may have had the same secret.
Sure. I mean, why not? The thing is that, again, I don't think this stuff is buried. And I think if you look at those pyramids and don't see a tomb,
mm-hmm.
and you have the kind of mind it takes to decipher this sort of stuff, which is not me, I'm the documentarian, but all I'm trying to do is get enough people interested so that the people with the specialized education that you need to fathom this sort of thing can figure it out.
Makes sense. All right, first time caller line, you're on the air with Boris Saeed. Good morning.
Good morning. This is the first time caller. My name's Scott from Washington, D.C.
Yes.
I just had a question for Boris.
Sure.
And I was listening to you earlier discussing the sonics relating to Orion and the pyramids.
Yes.
And my question was what alignment was the gentleman using when he came up with the alignment for the pyramids in Orion? Was he using the present-day alignment or the alignment of Orion roughly at the building of the pyramids?
I think he was using the Orion roughly at the building of the pyramids. I think specifically he was going back. Now, I may be wrong, but my understanding of the Orion mystery is that he was looking at it in 12,500 B.C., which was the dawning of the Age of Leo, which is when they feel the Sphinx was built.
Okay.
Isn't that right, Art?
Yes.
That was my understanding of it. And that's when the air shafts or star shafts lined up with the stars in Orion.
Right.
Okay, I was just listening tonight, and I had not heard that, and it was just a question in my mind. And one quick comment. A number of people online on your show tonight have mentioned the Masons.
Yes.
And I've been a Mason since I was 21. I've been a Mason for about 15 years. And just for your edification, the little eye on the back of the $1 bill is emblematic of the all-seeing eye or the eye of God. And it comes from Masonry, which a lot of our forefathers were members of that fraternity.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the texts from Declaration of Independence and the Constitution also came out of Masonic rituals.
You wouldn't want to tell us all the real secrets, huh?
Well, in all honesty, the real secrets of Masonry are modes of recognition. They're not a secret society because they publish where they meet and when they meet in the phone book. At least that's never been my definition of a secret society. It's basically modes of recognition, you know.
Well, I mean, the Council on Foreign Relations does all that, too.
Exactly. You know, it's an organization with secrets as opposed to a secret organization.
All right.
And it's mostly, like Shriners, for example, are members of the Masonic fraternity. And you've probably seen shrine hospitals all over this country.
Of course.
And the East-West Shrine Game, and they basically they raise money so that any child that they take care of does not have to pay for the medical treatment they receive, so they can take care of a child regardless of the income of their family.
Well, if we had Richard Hoagland here, he'd rip you to shreds.
Oh, there's all kinds of people that go back and forth on this.
What do you think about Lincoln's claim that not the president, but Lincoln, who wrote Holy Blood, Holy Grail, his claim that the Masonic Order was founded to preserve the knowledge of where the descendants of Christ were?
I think that's probably stretching it a bit. I think that there was a good book. And at this hour of the morning, the name just escapes me. But they talk about maybe it derived out of the Knights Templar who were destroyed by the Knights Hospitaller under Philip the Fair back in France in the early 1300s. And that the reason it was so secret was that they were literally having to protect their lives. And so they made sure there were lots of rituals as far as modes of recognition and handshakes and everything. Because literally, there was a writ for their warrant for their arrest.
Huh.
And, you know, if they were captured, at least in France, they were executed. In most of the other countries, they weren't, but in some countries, they were. That was one speculation. I don't know. I just think it grew out of the operative masons, and they had their lodges where the operative masons met. And as the stonemasonry trade decreased, I just think that they needed to bring in speculative people, people who were not actual masons. But masonry basically teaches a lesson. They take a moral application and they tie it to a lesson of a tool, like the 24-inch gauge is emblematical of the 24 hours of the day, where it's divided into equal parts for 8 hours for devotion to God, 8 hours to family, and 8 hours to your usual vocation. I mean, that's the type of thing that I've ever grown up with.
Uh-huh.
So I read some of these books, and I have a whole lot of them in my library about, you know, just these wild things that go on. I've joined all kinds of organizations that go, gosh, darn it, you know what? I've been in this organization now for 15 years. I've never seen that.
What level of masonry are you at?
I'm a 32nd degree mason, Scottish Rite.
Well, see, you've got just one more degree to go, and then you'll know it all.
Oh, that's true, yeah.
All right, thank you very much for the call. We're short on time. East of the Rockies, you're on there with Boris Said. Hello. Going once, going twice.
Hello?
Yes, hello. Hello? I guess not.
We lost him, Mark.
Yep. West of the Rockies, you're on there with Boris Said. Hi.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen. Boris, you may be right with the sonic idea. I've always had a speculation that moving those large granite pieces on the pyramid could have been done with a harmonic vibration, and once they've got the giant boulder moving, they could, through vibration, they could move it through more physical aspects easier.
It may be. That's a good point, that once they get all the right vibrations going,
right,
stones will begin to lift.
Yep.
That would be something like anti-gravity, wouldn't it? Boris, we're out of time.
Oh.
It has been a pleasure.
Well, it's been my pleasure, Art. I hope I can send out a lot of cassettes and inform a lot of people as to what we've really done. Thank you for the opportunity.
Boris, good night, and thank you.
Good night. Thank you, Art.
I think it's been the best show that we've done on the pyramids to date, the one I've always wanted to do from the high desert. Good night.